and where we are met with cynicism and doubt, and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can.
Yes, 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 it's time. We all come together. Ha-ha.
Greetings. Welcome, everybody, to the Galactic Roundtable. We're going to jump right into hard news tonight.
Greetings.
Greetings. I guess that's you, or Rama.
Oh, God. I guess.
It's hotter than a cat on a hot tin roof.
Yeah. It is.
Yes, Rama got a little call a couple of days ago that was really good news, and we didn't tell everybody yet.
Oh.
Yes, it was on our last night at Lady Master Kathy's home.
Oh, yes.
And we went out. We were having fun, and we went out to get some ice cream because we made a homemade apple pie, and we had made a homemade peach pie, and we ran out of ice cream from that one.
That's right.
Anyway, we got some dessert for sure in terms of a phone call that you got.
And I was listening to Delilah out there, Magic 99 FM. And she just said, you know, she was playing the song, You Raise Me Up, by Josh Groden. And she just said, you know, those of you out there who have been waiting for what is about to happen, you're about to get it in the face. And it has to do with the abundance, because you raise me up with what's going on. This is on the highest levels with what's happening in terms of the big news as we approach 9/11. And our Reichstag fire, you could call it. And to this day, there are still stories that are being told that have not been told about what occurred the morning of that day when we were supposed to have the Nasara announcement. Alan Greenspan was supposed to do this, yet we all know what occurred. And to this day, all the pieces haven't been told. And as of late, this afternoon, I got a call from Joe Wilson, of all people.
What?
Yes. And I will just say that what is being said out there has to do with the whole story being told. And you have a slice of that, American journalist that had video, Beth, that you posted on the Galactic Roundtable, and
yeah.
He's Argentina, and there are many stories about people who were there filming the so-called staged event. This is what Joel Wilson talked about to me today. There were two events, three maybe, or four going on. And you could say it was like a very bad version of the Keystone Cops. And no pun intended, but FEMA was doing an exercise. And they were, you know, it was...
Ron, what were they doing? Were they stuffing clowns in a small, small car?
No.
Give me a break.
What I'm trying to tell you is what Joe Wilson said. There were many people of FEMA that were there, and FEMA was doing an exercise, an event that was in the event of some kind of attack. These procedures would be done, and there would be, you know, volunteers that would be on the ground as if those were victims. And people were doing, you know, the different kinds of first aid after the fact of some kind of staged event, in a sense, if it had happened. See, and what Joe Wilson was saying is many people that within the agencies were never told by other members within the agencies that what was going to happen was this was the real deal. And lines and communications got confused. And this journalist is one of those people that may have worked for FEMA, and then it turned into the real deal, and people died. And up to 75,000 plus people to this day that have not been talked about, not one or two or 3,000. This is why to this day they are still finding bones on the rooftops of buildings in Manhattan And if you're caught up there, I guess, well, I don't know what to say.
Rama.
At this point, what Joe Wilson is saying, that we are about to see all of the events that led up to 9/11 come out, including the outing of his wife, which never should have happened. And Scooter Libby, Karl Rove, George Bush are directly responsible, along with Tony Blair. And, I mean, this is big.
Rama.
Yes.
I want to get clarification on what you said. It was a mouthful.
Tell me about it.
So, when FEMA did this exercise, when did they do this exercise?
That same morning.
Right. You've mentioned that before, haven't you?
They even had videos of it in various places across the internet. And, you know, the way Randy Rhodes put it, the whole time since 9/11, every time I've heard Randy Rhodes bring up 9/11, she said, why was Strategic Air Command told to stand down for over an hour? And, I mean, that was never, ever done. And,
right.
I mean,
At the same time the planes were in the sky, then they were also doing a FEMA exercise, and they were also in the, you know, on the ground floor at the World Trade Center waiting to announce Nassar with Alan Greenspan, right?
Mm-hmm.
All those things were going on at the same time, and we never knew.
We never knew. And what was just being shown to the people was, you know, for a few minutes, maybe an hour to 2 hours into 9/11, we were seeing real footage as the media were covering it. Then it changed. It all changed.
Because they were starting to take the film footage into the lab and change it before they'd put it on TV.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because all of this has to do with the cover-up of what occurred. And like Ashtar said just yesterday, that, you know, we were there. We beamed people up. I mean, I have photos of that. And a few other folks out on the internet have photos of those craft that showed up alongside the towers as people were jumping, and they put a beam on them and beamed them up to the ships.
On the video that Sam Cedar sent you, on one of those videos, there's a starship clearly evident right in the video, and I pasted, you know, all the commentary that went with it, but in one of them, I noted and I said, do you see the starship that's on this video?
Yeah. And in Japan, they have that same photo. And it's kind of interesting. They have this cartoon balloon with this, like, communication in it. And it's, you know, like what they would put in the comics. And it's translated below the Japanese and it says, what is this? And it's like, you know, they are making it plain. This was a craft that was being told in no uncertain terms that, you know, it clearly was shown to the people that we are here. We want you to know this. And it is time for your governments to talk about us.
Rama.
Yes.
Sorry, I just have a question about Yukio, the prime minister who stepped down a few months ago. He was in the Japanese papers yesterday saying he believes that Japan should work more with its Asian partners. And I was wondering if you ever heard a scoop about what happened with him. And I know that they had problems with the financial minister, had to step down, and then it sounds like there was a scramble in their government, and I was wondering if you ever got any clarity about that. nobody has said much in the news.
I haven't seen much about that, and I haven't looked at Mr. Benjamin Fulford lately. So what I would say about all of this is that, as we are already hearing, there's treasury banking going on. I mean, there is rainbow money in the banks, and it is at the place where...
It's been there for ages.
Yes, and it's time for Saint Germain to drop the dime and to talk about this with the Syrian commander.
On TV, huh?
On TV. This is why I'm saying this, and it's falling out of my mouth. When he talked in Cleveland, Ohio today, it sounded like he was in full...
It wasn't today, was it?
I think it was. Maybe yesterday.
It was yesterday.
No, it was today. It was today.
Yeah.
It was today?
It was today.
This is why Mr. Boner is having a boner over this. Because it's home turf. He wants to be Speaker of the House and rub Nancy's face in it. And Mr. Boner is going to jail for contributing to, let's bring up, Jack Abramoff, Tom DeLay, Randy Duke Cunningham, and so on. Mr. John Boner's involved in that.
Sexgate.
Yeah.
He got his boner in the wrong place.
And
DeMint, too, right?
Jim DeMint, Governor Ted Stevens, bless his heart, is on the other side, yet I don't think St. Peter has given him a break. I don't know. It's none of my business.
Well, St. Peter, he's the one that denied three times, so he's got to deal with that.
Yeah, I know. He's got his own issues with the man.
Those issues have been worked out a long time ago. I have news for you.
Oh, tell me about it. The chair of Peter got usurped a long time ago by Vader and his forces.
That's right.
Yes, there is no... The Office of the Christ, in all honesty, the Office of the Christ is an office that is held by incredible God beings who are no different than you or I. They have ascended from this lifetime. Mr. Swami Purna is one of them that's sitting with us right now. That's why they call him Sri Maharaj. No accident. Raja Yoga is the path. And what I'm saying is that when you sit in the office of the Christ over a land area like, let's say, North and South America, Turtle Island, you sit in that office for maybe 100,000 years because you're immortal and you chose that position to do that. And what I'm not trying to change the subject or anything, Beth, but I'm trying
There isn't any other subject. This is the subject.
Oh, okay.
My favorite subject.
I am just saying that Saint Germain might be, I don't know how updated all this info is, but I heard he was the new Maha Chauhan, if this is
That's true. I heard that.
The new Maha Chauhan for what ray?
I would say the seventh ray. I don't know what saying.
I concur, Commander.
Well, is that a higher position than being on the seventh ray, the way he's been?
I'm not prepared to answer because I don't know.
Tara, the research I have done says yes.
Okay. And that means all of us have to take a more responsible role then. When the master moves up, we move into the position where the master was, and we best be prepared to do that.
And this dude's my cousin.
Well, cousin Schmuzzin, we just got to be in that new work.
Yes.
As Earth ascends, each one of us ascends. So whatever position we're holding in the office of the Christ now, we're moving up. And that's what we're all preparing for, waking up to.
This is why I firmly believe Joe Wilson called me up today and just said, dude, heads up, as we approach 9/11, you know, it's still out there. My wife was outed, and to this day, there's been no closure about the covert outing of a CIA operative. This is huge. And
not to mention that it was Joe Wilson way back in the summer of 2006 that told Rama that over 2 million of our soldiers were already dead.
That's right.
And that was in 2006, everybody.
So
it's a long list of things we haven't identified or faced as a co-consensus, as a consciousness in our in America or around the world. And I want to mention that I have a request to everyone. The most important thing you can do right now when you're doing your meditations and your chanting and your prayers is, Lord Ashtar was speaking to us last night and he said, we have had to wait because consciousness wasn't ready. So keep it in your prayers and send love to everyone who's not awake or sleepy and they're on their way and they haven't figured it out yet, and continue to support and lift these ones up with love as much as you can, because none of us will go without all of us going.
This is what I mean, as you say this, it comes back to Delilah, and she doesn't talk about this stuff. She only plays sappy, sticky, sweet love songs.
She calls you up in the middle of her sappy, sticky, sweet love songs and says, Rama, get ready. It's about to hit you in the face.
That's right.
Your blessing.
And I'm saying to her, what about, you know, war crimes? What about accountability?
What about arrest?
And she's just saying, you lift me up. In that sense, the understanding, as we are calling for this, the one who is in charge comes forward and says, okay, now it's time. And I think that this is right now the one who stepped up to the plate in John Boehner's home turf, Cleveland, Ohio, where Dennis Kucinich to this day still is helping the people. And what I'm trying to say here is the fact of the matter, Mr. Boehner, his name is in the D.C. Madam Palfrey's Black Book over a dozen times.
Oh.
And that's a baker's dozen, mind you, not just a regular dozen.
There's an extra one in there.
Yeah, 13. So he's got to deal with Mother. Mm-hmm. And this is why right now would be in everybody's best interest to vote this man out of office and arrest him for high crimes, misdemeanors. This is the deal. Mr. Obama spoke to the people as if I saw him on, you know, 2008 when he was campaigning. This is what I saw today with his energy.
We're going to listen to that, right?
Yes.
We're going to listen to
the whole thing. We have to listen to that.
And this is about fear versus victory, and it's nothing else. All these people have is the fear card. And this brings in the story, Lao Tzu, The Secret Art of War. Mm-hmm. Wizards, the movie. You should rent this movie or watch it somehow on the internet because it explains this story of Lao Tzu, The Secret Art of War. And the whisperings of Worm Tongue as he took King Theoden's ear in Lord of the Rings and turned him into a shriveled up old man. Where
who was this guy?
Wormtongue was,
yeah, who was he?
He was Saruman's assistant in
Dark Wizards. Assistant.
He was one of the Dark Wizards who turned to the dark side after he was lured by Sauron, the Dark Lord, with one of the Seeing Stones. And Worm Tongue.
It was the King of Rohan who he was
King of Rohan, yes.
We can play some music from Lord of the Rings. Yes. That's what we can do.
And what is being said right now is Mr. Boner represents the whisperings of Worm Tongue, which is just lies. All they have is fear, and there's nothing else. Mr. Obama was born at 19.5 degrees, the son of Malcolm X. He is the man.
Well, he's got the role to play. And
that's right.
May we all pass our tests in every role that we have volunteered to play together.
You know, there's an important part of this story. The King of Rohan's daughter, the princess, Worm Tongue tried to move in on her, and she was representing Divine Feminine, and then she went into war with her sword. And when her father was being attacked by the Nagual said to her, you know, when she tried to hit it with her sword and they got into a fight, the Nagual said to her, "No man can kill me." And she threw off her helmet and revealed her long golden hair. She said, "I am no man." And she killed
That's
him.
That's right. Yeah.
That's Divine Feminine being in charge of taking back all the Worm Tongues of the world, sending them back to Mother, sending them back to creation. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. That's a woman doing that. And that's how we win the war.
Yes, it's time to put the axe behind us.
It's time for peace on earth.
So be it.
And it's woman who will do it, and that's Mother Sex.
Yes, and what I keep hearing out there from all the whistleblowers is that this particular 9/11, with the issues that are going on, there were two or three, I'm not sure how many U.S. soldiers died in Iraq in the last day or two. Amy talked about it on her show today, and it's just...
Two more today.
Yes, it's time to bring our children home. Some of them, not even children, they've become men, and they left as children, yet they're still children having to heal the child within who got squashed and told, it's time to kill. Yeah. I passed the talking stick.
I have a song queued up. Can I just hit the button? Can we have music now?
Please.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Enjoy then.
Amazing people on, and we have been lucky enough to have a lot of big people on. This guy is incredible. His first CD sold 5 million copies. The new one, Closer, just went gold. Please welcome the incredible Josh Groban.
Down and throw my soul so weary. When troubles come and my heart burden be, then I am still and wait here in silence until you come and sit a while with me. You raise me up so standing on mountains, you raise me up to walk on stormy seas. I am strong, I am on your shoulders. Raise me up to more than I can be. You raise me up so I can stand.
Galetta's very good at what she does, you know.
Yes.
That was beautiful. Thank you for playing that. Since that was the theme song of what we were talking about.
Thank you, Delilah.
Yes, Delilah, thank you. She's the one. She said all along, you know, that she was going to let us know.
Big Will's been waiting quite a while here.
Sorry, Big Will.
Big Will, you're on line A1. We can't hear you yet, though. Hello. Okay, Big Will. Well,
sorry, you guys.
Maybe you can call.
Say, I don't know the number. Do you know them?
Say that again.
I'm sorry, I don't know the numbers to have people call in.
Oh, well, Seth, will you put those up on the board again so we can read them? In the meantime.
One of the most important things we can do tonight is everybody needs to hear what President Barack Obama said today in Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay, I will go with that.
Awesome.
It's still hope versus fear. This is what's going on.
Hope went out.
I can give you the numbers if you'd like me to read those for you.
You're a little bit hard to hear. Oh, there you go.
530-413-4511. 530-413-4515. And then 530-413-4520.
You got to tell them about this. Okay. And 530-413-45. Oh, there's Beth. Oh, no, that's.
I'm putting it up there so I can look at it later.
Oh, okay, 4515.
So
okay.
The first one is 4511, second one 4515, third one 4520. And
they
all begin 530413.
Okay, thank you, Marina Roberts. I wanted to say before we go to listen to Barack that everybody that was a participant in my gifts are I Am activities. I'll just put it that way. There's we're being ushered into another activity as it wasn't possible to do it in that activity due to many things, yet we're being ushered in, and we have until midnight on Friday morning, you might say, 12:01 a.m. Friday morning. It's the end of this. So please schedule yourself to take a look at your I Am activity new phase, and everybody please engage, because what I'm reading here is this is this is what we've really been waiting for.
I will just say email me, that's all.
Okay. It's Koran, K-O-R-A-N, 999 at Comcast.net. And you talked to the king a little bit about this, right?
I did, yet I would volunteer to share that personally as people, we speak to people personally.
Yes. So send us an email, those of us who have already participated, okay?
Okay.
We will go from there. And other than that, Rama's in the process of getting his teeth fixed. It's on its way, finally.
Oh,
it
yes.
It made its way a few roundabout ways, and it's
okay.
On its way now.
Here we go with Obama.
Okay.
In ready. Cleveland, Ohio.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ohio. Thank you, Cleveland. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you very much, everybody. Everybody, please have a seat. Have a seat. We've got some business to do today. Thank you very much. I love you back. Thank you. Before I get started, I want to just acknowledge some outstanding public servants who are here. First of all, somebody who I believe is one of the finest governors in this country, Ted Strickland, is here. The lieutenant governor and soon-to-be junior senator from the great state of Illinois, Ohio. I was thinking about my own home. Lee Fisher is here. Yeah, I used to hear that line all the time about senator from Illinois. That would be me. Outstanding mayor of Cleveland, Frank Jackson, is here. The mayor of Parma, Dean DePerio. Somebody who's fighting for working families each and every day, Senator Sherrod Brown, is here. And three of the hardest working and finest members of the House of Representatives, Dennis Kucinich, Marcia Fudge, and John Bocelli. Good afternoon, everybody. It is good to be back in Ohio. You know, in the fall of 2008, one of the last rallies of my presidential campaign was right here in the Cleveland area. It was a hopeful time, just 2 days before the election. And we knew that if we pulled it off, we finally had the chance to tackle some big and difficult challenges that had been facing this country for a very long time. We also hoped for a chance to get beyond some of the old political divides between Democrats and Republicans, red states and blue states, that had prevented us from making progress. Because although we are proud to be Democrats, we are prouder to be Americans. And we believe then and we believe now that no single party has a monopoly on wisdom. That's not to say that the election didn't expose deep differences between the parties. I ran for president because for much of the last decade, a very specific governing philosophy had reigned about how America should work. Cut taxes, especially for millionaires and billionaires. Cut regulations for special interests. cut trade deals, even if they didn't benefit our workers. Cut back on investments in our people and in our future, in education and clean energy and research and technology. The idea was that if we just had blind faith in the market, if we let corporations play by their own rules, we left everyone else to fend for themselves, then America would grow and America would prosper. And for a time, this idea gave us the illusion of prosperity. We saw financial firms and CEOs take in record profits and record bonuses. We saw a housing boom that led to new homeowners and new jobs in construction. Consumers bought more condos and bigger cars and better TVs. But while all this was happening, the broader economy was becoming weaker. Nobody understands that more than the people of Ohio. Job growth between 2000 and 2008 was slower than it had been in any economic expansion since World War II. Slower than it's been over the last year. The wages and incomes of middle class families kept falling, while the cost of everything from tuition to health care kept on going up. Folks were forced to put more debt on their credit cards and borrow against homes that many couldn't afford to buy in the first place. And meanwhile, a failure to pay for two wars and two tax cuts for the wealthy helped turn a record surplus into a record deficit. I ran for president because I believed that this kind of economy was unsustainable for the middle class and for the future of our nation. I ran because I had a different idea about how America was built. It was an idea. It was an idea rooted in my own family's story. You see, Michelle and I are where we are today because even though our families didn't have much, they worked tirelessly, without complaint, that we might have a better life. My grandfather marched off to Europe in World War II, while my grandmother worked in factories on the home front. I had a single mom who put herself through school and would wait before dawn to make sure I got a decent education. Michelle can still remember her father heading out to his job as a city worker long after multiple sclerosis had made it impossible for him to walk without crutches. He always got to work. He just had to get up a little earlier. Yes, our families believed in the American values of self-reliance and individual responsibility, and they instilled those values in their children. But they also believed in a country that rewards responsibility, a country that rewards hard work, a country built on the promise of opportunity and upward mobility. They believed in an America that gave my grandfather the chance to go to college because of the GI Bill. An America that gave my grandparents the chance to buy a home because of the Federal Housing Authority. An America that gave their children and grandchildren the chance to fulfill our dreams thanks to college loans and college scholarships. It was an America where you didn't buy things you couldn't afford. Where we didn't just think about today, we thought about tomorrow. America that took pride in the goods that we made, not just the things we consumed. America where a rising tide really did lift all boats. from the company CEO to the guy on the assembly line. That's the America I believe in. That's the America I believe in. That's what led me to work in the shadow of the shuttered steel plant on the south side of Chicago when I was a community organizer. It's what led me to fight for factory workers and manufacturing plants that were closing across Illinois when I was senator. It's what led me to run for president. Because I don't believe we can have a strong and growing economy without a strong and growing middle class. Now, much has happened since that election. The flawed policies and economic weaknesses of the previous decade culminated in a financial crisis and the worst recession of our lifetimes. And my hope was that the crisis would cause everybody, Democrats and Republicans, to pull together and tackle our problems in a practical way. But as we all know, things didn't work out that way. Some Republican leaders figured it was smart politics to sit on the sidelines and let Democrats solve the mess. Others believed on principle that government shouldn't meddle in the markets, even when the markets are broken. But with the nation losing nearly 800,000 jobs the month that I was sworn into office, my most urgent task was to stop a financial meltdown and prevent this recession from becoming a second depression. At Ohio, we have done that. The economy is growing again. The financial markets have stabilized. The private sector has created jobs for the last 8 months in a row. And there are roughly 3 million Americans who are working today because of the economic plan we put into place. But the truth is, progress has been painfully slow. Millions of jobs were lost before our policies even had a chance to take effect. We lost 4 million jobs in the 6 months before I took office. There was a hole so deep that even though we've added jobs again, millions of Americans remain unemployed. Hundreds of thousands of families have lost their homes. Millions more can barely pay the bills or make the mortgage. The middle class is still treading water. And those aspiring to reach the middle class are doing everything they can to keep from drowning. And meanwhile, some of the very steps that were necessary to save the economy, like temporarily supporting the banks and the auto industry, fed the perception that Washington is still ignoring the middle class in favor of special interests. And so people are frustrated, and they're angry, and they're anxious about the future. I understand that. I also understand that in the political campaign, the easiest thing for the other side to do is to ride this fear and anger all the way to election day. That's what's happening right now. A few weeks ago, the Republican leader of the House came here to Cleveland and offered his party's answer to our economic challenges. Now, it would be one thing if he had admitted his party's mistakes during the 8 years that they were in power, if they had gone off for a while and meditated and come back and offered a credible new approach to solving our country's problems. But that's not what happened. There were no new policies for Mr. Bannon. There were no new ideas.
I'm not sure what happened.
He said that Bush could have said Ho'oponopono meditated and told us he was going to do things different, but he didn't do that.
Just go click on there again.
Okay.
Click back on.
I'm going to have to go ahead a little.
Go ahead a little.
Okay,
that's off. That's off, isn't it?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it is. Okay, try that. Now those people move. Now just turn it back on. Oh, that's off. Okay, now.
I'm not sure what's going on. I think it's...
Do you think that it has
to... I might have too many things open. I have to close this.
Are you ready to try again?
Yeah.
Oh, you can't go that far.
It won't let me go that far.
It's not starting. Do you have to reboot and start and push it forward?
I might have to redo the page.
Why don't we do that, and why don't we play a piece of music?
Just a second. It's going to restart.
Thank you, Ohio! Thank you,
Sam! I'm going to try to go forward.
I have to stop.
Roll it forward.
Right about here.
Is Earl still on waiting while we're having technical challenges here? Did he have a comment or did he drop off?
You want to try again?
I'm just...
The easiest thing for the other side to do is to ride this fear and anger all the way to election day.
Okay. See if we get past it now.
That's what's happening right now. A few weeks ago, the Republican leader of the House came here to Cleveland and offered his party's answer to our economic challenges. Now, it would be one thing if he had admitted his party's mistakes during the 8 years that they were in power. And they had gone off for a while and meditated and come back and offered a credible new approach to solving our country's problems. But that's not what happened. There were no new policies for Mr. Boehner. There were no new ideas. It was just the same philosophy that we had already tried during the decade that they were in power. The same philosophy that led to this mess in the first place. Cut more taxes for millionaires and cut more rules for corporations. Instead of coming together like past generations did to build a better country for our children and grandchildren, their argument is that we should let insurance companies go back to denying care for folks who are sick. Or let credit card companies go back to raising rates without any reason. Instead of setting our sights higher, they're asking us to settle for a status quo of stagnant growth and eroding competitiveness and a shrinking middle class. That is not the America I know. That is not the America we believe in. A lot has changed since I came here in those final days of the last election. But what hasn't changed is the choice facing this country. It's still fear versus hope, the past versus the future. It's still a choice between sliding backward and moving forward. That's what this election is about. That's the choice that you will face in November. And we have a different vision for the future. See, I've never believed that government has all the answers to our problems. I've never believed that government's role is to create jobs or prosperity. I believe it's the drive and the ingenuity of our entrepreneurs, our small businesses, the skill and dedication of our workers that's made us the wealthiest nation on earth. I believe it's the private sector that must be the main engine for our recovery. I believe government should be lean. Government should be efficient. I believe government should leave people free to make the choices they think are best for themselves and their families, so long as those choices don't hurt others. But in the words of the first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, I also believe the government should do for the people what they cannot do better for themselves. And that means making the long-term investments in this country's future that individuals and corporations can't make on their own. Investments in education and clean energy, in basic research and technology and infrastructure. That means making sure corporations live up to their responsibilities to treat consumers fairly and play by the same rules as everybody else. Their responsibility is to look out for their workers, as well as their shareholders, and create jobs here at home. And that means providing a hand up for middle-class families. So if they work hard and meet their responsibilities, they can afford to raise their children and send them to college, see a doctor when they get sick, retire with dignity and respect. That's what we Democrats believe in. A vibrant free market, but one that works for everybody. That's our vision. That's our vision for a stronger economy and a growing middle class. And that's the difference between what we and Republicans in Congress are offering the American people right now. Now let me give you a few specific examples of our different approaches. This week, I proposed some additional steps to grow the economy and help businesses spur hiring. One of the keys to job creation is to encourage companies to invest more in the United States. But for years, our tax code has actually given billions of dollars in tax breaks that encourage companies to create jobs and profits in other countries. I want to change that. Instead of tax loopholes that incentivize investment in overseas jobs, I'm proposing a more generous, permanent extension of the tax credit that goes to companies for all the research and innovation they do right here in Ohio, right here in the United States of America. And I'm proposing that all American businesses should be allowed to write off all the investment they do in 2011. And this will help small businesses upgrade their plants and equipment, and will encourage large corporations to get off the sidelines and start putting their profits to work in places like Cleveland and Toledo and Dayton. Now, to most of you, I'll bet this just seems like common sense. But not to Mr. Boehner and his allies. 4 years, Republicans had fought to keep these corporate loopholes open. In fact, when Mr. Boehner was here in Cleveland, he attacked us for closing a few of these loopholes and using the money to help states like Ohio keep hundreds of thousands of teachers and cops and firefighters on the job. Mr. Boehner dismissed these jobs we saved, teaching our kids, patrolling our streets, rushing into burning buildings, as, quote, government jobs. Jobs, I guess, he thought just weren't worth saving. And I couldn't disagree more. I think teachers and police officers and firefighters are part of what keeps America strong. And Ohio, I think if we're going to give tax breaks to companies, they should go to companies that create jobs here in America, not that create jobs overseas. That's one difference between the Republican vision and the Democratic vision. That's what this election is all about.
You tell them, Barack.
Now, let me give you another example. We want to put more Americans back to work rebuilding America. Our roads, our railways, our runways. When the housing sector collapsed and the recession hit, one in every four jobs lost were in the construction industry. That's partly why our economic plan has invested in badly needed infrastructure projects over the last 19 months. Not just roads and bridges, but high-speed railroads and expanded broadband access. Altogether, these projects have led to thousands of good private sector jobs, especially for those in the trades. Mr. Boehner and the Republicans in Congress said no to these projects, fought them tooth and nail. Though I should say it didn't stop a lot of them from showing up at the ribbon cuttings, trying to take credit. That's always a sight to see. Now, there are still thousands of miles of railroads and railways and runways left to repair and improve. And engineers, economists, governors, mayors of every political stripe believe that if we want to compete in this global economy, we need to rebuild this vital infrastructure. There is no reason Europe or China should have the fastest trains or the most modern airports. We want to put America to work building them right here in America. So, this week, I proposed a 6-year infrastructure plan that would start putting Americans to work right away. But, despite the fact that this has traditionally been an issue with bipartisan support, Mr. Boehner has so far said no to infrastructure. That's bad for America. And that, too, is what this election is all about. I'll give you one final example of the differences between us and the Republicans, and that's on the issue of tax cuts. Under the tax plan passed by the last administration, taxes are scheduled to go up substantially next year. For everybody. By the way, this was by design. when they passed these tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, they didn't want everybody to know what it would do to our deficit. So they pretended like they were going to end, even though now they say they don't. Now, I believe we ought to make the tax cuts for the middle class permanent. For the middle class permanent. These families are the ones who saw their wages and incomes flatline over the last decade. You deserve a break.
Yes.
You deserve some help. And because folks in the middle class are more likely to spend their tax cut on basic necessities, that strengthens the economy as a whole. But the Republican leader of the House doesn't want to stop there. Ain't no mistake. He and his party believe we should also give a permanent tax cut to the wealthiest 2% of Americans.
Uh-uh.
With all the other budgetary pressures we have, with all the Republicans talk about wanting to shrink the deficit, they would have us borrow $700 billion over the next 10 years to give a tax cut of about $100,000 each to folks who are already millionaires.
Mm-hmm.
And keep in mind, wealthy Americans are just about the only folks who saw their incomes rise when Republicans were in charge.
Uh-huh.
And these are the folks who are less likely to spend the money, which is why economists don't think tax breaks for the wealthy would do much to boost the economy. So, let me be clear to Mr. Boehner and everybody else. We should not hold middle-class tax cuts hostage any longer. We are ready this week, if they want, to give tax cuts to every American making $250,000 or less. That's 98-97% of Americans. Now, for any income over this amount, the tax rates would just go back to what they were under President Clinton. This isn't to punish folks who are better off. God bless them. It's because we can't afford the $700 billion price tag. And for those who claim that our approach would somehow be bad for growth and bad for small businesses, let me remind you that with those tax rates in place under President Clinton, this country created 22 million jobs and raised incomes and had the largest surplus in our history. In fact, if the Republican leadership in Congress really wants to help small business, they'll stop using legislative maneuvers to block an up or down vote on a small business job bill that's before the Senate right now. Right now. This is a bill that would do two things. It would cut taxes for small businesses and make loans more available for small businesses. It is fully paid for, won't add to the deficit, and it was written by Democrats and Republicans. And yet, the other party continues to block this jobs bill. A delay that small business owners have said is actually leading them to put off hiring. Look, I recognize that most of the Republicans in Congress have said no to just about every policy I proposed since taking office.
That's right.
I realize in some cases that there are genuine philosophical differences. But on issues like this one, a tax cut for small businesses supported by the Chamber of Commerce, the only reason they're holding this up is politics. Pure and simple. They're making the same calculation they made just before my inauguration. If I fail, they win. Well, they might think that this will get them to where they want to go in November. But it won't get our country going where it needs to go in the long run. It won't get us there. It won't get us there. It won't get us there. So that's the choice, Olav. Do we return to the same failed policies that ran our economy into a ditch? Or do we keep moving forward with policies that are slowly pulling us out? Do we settle for a slow decline? Or do we reach for an America with a growing economy and a thriving middle class? That's the America that I see. We may not be there yet, but we know where this country needs to go. We see a future where we invest in American innovation and American ingenuity, where we export more goods so we create more jobs here at home, where we make it easier to start a business or patent an invention, where we build a homegrown clean energy industry, because I don't want to see new solar panels or electric cars or advanced batteries manufactured in Europe or in Asia. I want to see them made right here in the U.S. of A. by American workers.
With my shuttlecraft.
Enough.
We see an America where every citizen has the skills and training to compete with any worker in the world. That's why we've set a goal to once again have the highest proportion of college graduates in the world by 2020.
Cool.
That's why we're revitalizing community colleges like this one. That's why we're reforming our education system based on what works for our children, not what perpetuates the status quo. We see an America where a growing middle class is the beating heart of a growing economy. That's why I kept my campaign promise and gave a middle class tax cut to 95% of working Americans. That's why we passed health insurance reform that stops insurance companies from jacking up your premiums at will or denying coverage because you get sick. That's why we passed financial reform that will end taxpayer-funded bailouts, reform that will stop credit card companies and mortgage lenders from taking advantage of taxpayers and consumers. That's why we're trying to make it easier for workers to save for retirement and fighting the efforts of some and the other party to privatize Social Security, because as long as I'm president, no one is going to take the retirement savings of a generation of Americans and hand it over to Wall Street.
Amen.
Not on my watch.
Amen.
That's why we're fighting to extend the child tax credit and make permanent our new college tax credit. Because if we do, it will mean $10,000 in tuition relief for each child going to 4 years of college. And I don't want any parent not to be sending their kids in good time or bad to college because they can't afford it. And finally, we see an America where we refuse to pass on the debt we inherited to the next generation. Now, let me spend just a minute on this issue, because we've heard a lot of moralizing on the other side about this, government spending and debt. Along with the tax cuts for the wealthy, the other party's main economic proposal is that they'll stop government spending. Now, it's right to be concerned about the long-term deficit. If we don't get a handle on it soon, it can endanger our future. And at a time when folks are tightening their belts at home, I understand why a lot of Americans feel it's time for government to show some discipline too. But let's look at the facts. When these same Republicans, including Mr. Boehner, were in charge, the number of earmarks and pet projects went up, not down. These same Republicans turned a record surplus into a record deficit. When I walked in, wrapped in a nice bow, was a $1.3 trillion deficit sitting right there on my doorstep. A welcoming present. Just this year, these same Republicans voted against a bipartisan fiscal commission that they themselves had proposed. Once I decided I was for it, they were against it. And when you ask them what programs they'd actually cut, they don't have an answer. That's not fiscal responsibility. That's not a serious plan to govern. Now, I'll be honest. I refuse to cut back on those investments that will grow our economy in the future. Investments in areas like education and clean energy and technology. I don't want to cut those things. And that's because economic growth is the single best way to bring down the deficit. And we need these investments to grow. But I am absolutely committed to fiscal responsibility, which is why I've already proposed freezing all discretionary spending unrelated to national security for the next 3 years. And once the bipartisan fiscal commission finishes its work, I'll spend the next year making the tough choices necessary to further reduce our deficit and lower our debt, whether I get help from the other side or not. Of course, reducing the deficit won't be easy. Making up for the 8 million lost jobs caused by this recession won't happen overnight. Not everything we've done over the last 2 years has worked as quickly as we had hoped. And I'm keenly aware that not all of our policies have been popular. So no, our job is not easy. But you didn't elect me to do what was easy. You didn't elect me to just read the polls and figure how to keep myself in office. You didn't elect me to avoid big problems. You elected me to do what was right. And as long as I'm president, that's exactly what I intend to do. This country is emerging from an incredibly difficult period in its history. An era of irresponsibility that stretched from Wall Street to Washington and had a devastating effect on a lot of people. We have started turning the corner on that era. But part of moving forward is returning to the time-honored values that built this country. Hard work and self-reliance. Responsibility for ourselves, but also responsibility for one another. Not moving from an attitude that said, what's in it for me? To one that asked, what's best for America? What's best for all our workers? What's best for all of our businesses? What's best for all of our children? These values are not Democratic or Republican. They are not conservative or liberal values. They are American values. As Democrats, we take pride in what our party has accomplished over the last century. Social Security and the minimum wage, the GI Bill and Medicare, civil rights and workers' rights and women's rights. But we also recognize that throughout our history, there has been a noble Republican vision as well of what this country can be. It was the vision of Abraham Lincoln, who set up the first land-grant colleges, launched the Transcontinental Railroad. The vision of Teddy Roosevelt, who used the power of government to break up monopolies. The vision of Dwight Eisenhower, who helped build the interstate highway system. And yes, the vision of Ronald Reagan, who, despite his aversion to government, was willing to help save Social Security for future generations, working with Democrats. These were serious leaders for serious times. They were great politicians, but they didn't spend all their time playing games. The scoring points. They didn't always prey on people's fears and anxieties. They made mistakes, but they did what they thought was in the best interests of their country and its people. And that's what the American people expect of us today. Democrats, independents, and Republicans. That's the debate they deserve. That's the leadership we owe them. I know that folks are worried about the future. I know there's still a lot of hurt out there. And when times are tough, I know it can be tempting to get into cynicism and fear and doubt and division. Just settle our sights a little bit lower. Settle for something a little bit less. But that's not who we are, Ohio. Those are not the values that built this country. We are here today because, in the worst of times, the people who came before us brought out the best in America. Because our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents were willing to work and sacrifice for us. They were willing to take great risks and face great hardship and reach for a future that would give us the chance at a better life. They knew that this country is greater than the sum of its parts. America's not about the ambitions of any one individual, but the aspirations of an entire people, an entire nation. That's who we are. That is our legacy. And I'm convinced that if we're willing to summon those values today, and if we're willing to choose hope over fear, and choose the future over the past, and come together once more around the great project of national renewal, then we will restore our economy and rebuild our middle class and reclaim the American dream for the next generation. Thank you. God bless you. And may God bless the United States of America. Thank you.
Well, what a great speech. What a great speech, eh?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
One of the most comprehensive speeches he's given in a long time. I mean, other than the other day, which was big, too.
Well,
What was with Boehner? He mentioned him a dozen, two dozen times. That was weird. What's going on with that?
What's going on with that is the fact that he is about to be exposed for who he is. That has to do with the Jack Abramoff, Tom DeLay, Randy Duke Cunningham, Ted Stevens. I can go on with the names of how Jack Abramoff, like Bernie Madoff, played with people's investments to the tune of trillions. And it was all about Bush and Cheney and the Carlyle Group. James Baker III, who is a wanted criminal across this planet.
Planet.
Yes.
It's very, very close to everybody. He made the speech that was needed to be made for the transition now.
That's right.
Wow.
This speech more or less underscored why the war criminals would want to do 9/11. It doesn't mention the two wars, but that's been talked about last week.
The reason being is that this was not on his watch. He walked into it.
There were 100,000 jobs lost the first month he was in office.
That's right.
That's ridiculous. And there's been, 100,000 every month after there, for several months. They had the bikini graph, and it was something like 8 months, and then it started to get lesser and lesser and lesser each month.
And he has single-handedly yet surrounding himself with the lions of Wall Street that are not good lions.
Not very good.
No, they are like Scar in the movie The Lion King.
Oh, gosh. That
traitors.
Yeah.
And, Geithner, Summers, all the rest are tied in with the Bush-Clinton-Carlyle crime family.
Bernanke,
Paulson, I can go on with the stories to the sky that go to the hedge fund managers who are losing their heads right, left, and center. And it goes back to the story I began with, the secret art of war. This is what they've been playing with, whether it's a war for your mind, like Alex Jones talks about, or a war for your soul, in that sense, as Lucifer, have I got a deal for you?
It's all one and the same. Once they have your mind, then they get your soul.
Right. And I just remember that scene of Cypher in The Matrix where he's chewing on the steak and he says, I know this is not real, yet it tastes so good. I want to stay in The Matrix. Agent Smith is licking his chops, got another one.
Yeah.
How much do we want to buy of the Matrix to the point where we sell our soul, like Peter, 3 times he denied to Christ. And, Tara was Peter's wife.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Yeah, not a pretty story these days.
But the Theodora was my name at that time.
Yeah.
Theodora. The thing is that the female were the the true disciples. That
yes.
Not that the male wasn't. It was that they were most challenged by the powers that be out in the world.
They were, and I disguised...
Women were just merely stoned to death, but you know.
Just like the lady in Iran right now for adultery.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, he who is without sin cast the first stone. And yet Ahmadinejad, understand, this man is essentially a good man, yet what has happened is the mullahs and the CIA, the NSA, the black ops that have played with the stories to the sky.
Behind.
Hedge funds. And the idea, what's going on with Iran, has to do where they do not want to play anymore with the dollar. And switching over to euros and ruples and other forms of currency, even the, whatever, the yuan in China, I don't know what it's going to be called.
You know what, we should do something if we're complete with this to watch. We have a 2-hour piece yet.
Oh my God, superpower.
And I think we should witness this because this is the whole story and it was put together.
I mean, this has so many whistleblowers.
Every whistleblower.
Like Valerie Plame, Karen Kwiatkowski, who was...
Kwiatkowski.
Was a general, and she...
At Abu Ghraib, she was in charge.
Yeah, and she just, like, you know, resigned her commission, everything. It just said, I need to tell the truth. Like Colonel Ann Wright, where she stands up and just says, this is an unlawful war.
Well, she nailed Rumsfeld for
Orders
that he had up on there for her to have to exercise.
Yeah.
For torture.
We will not torture. No.
Well, it's time for all of that. I do want to know if that would be okay with everyone to witness this. We would like to play an interlude from Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah.
And Beth, what do you think?
It's my favorite story ever, so I'll never complain about that. You know, Rama noticed if he just mentioned something about it, I start telling the whole story.
Okay.
Pull yourself forward.
You know, the voice is from Lord of the Rings, right?
Yeah.
Oh, it certainly is. Oh,
your mic sounds so good today. I'm looking forward to hearing what music sounds like with it.
Yes, and we want to go get one just like it. Take it with
us. Yeah.
It sounds so good. It's a major improvement.
Well, we have to thank Linda. Linda, thank you over there. She's got her headsets on in the other room.
Oh, it sounds very good over the phone. Just a minute here. Things are moving a bit in time warp, if you know what I mean.
I do.
Yeah.
I'm feeling a little strange tonight.
This is kind of an interesting love song. Aragorn and Arwen, Requiem.
Awesome. Thank you.
So
Kind of great.
Beautiful, beautiful. Good sound in the music department too.
Yeah.
This is a little jam. Very teeny tiny too.
Yeah, I don't know what the name of it is.
We'll see in the morning.
We'll call it Teeny Tiny Too. I like that.
Okay, I just want to know, Seth or whoever's on the other end of this. This is the 2-hour production, and it is. I guess we're well within our bounds, are we not?
Tara, we have 2 hours and 20 minutes left, so it's perfect.
All right, son. Maybe I'll even be able to sneak in my little story by Swami Purna.
You want to hear the superpower story?
Yes, let's do it now.
Okay.
Awesome.
Oh, my God, this is quite a heavy story. Ho'oponopono.
Yes. Ho'oponopono. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
It's going to buffer a little bit because I might have to reload the page.
Okay,
hang on.
Okay, so what do we want to share in the moment?
It'll take it just a second. Yeah, I'm just going to have to go and click on it again, and it might start with a new version of whatever's on free speech, so give it a moment.
Can I just say something quick?
Yes, Beth, go ahead.
Sorry, I just got an email from a friend of mine, and he has a handle, and his handle is the greenhouse.
Sorry. Go ahead. What was that?
A friend of mine just emailed, and his handle is the Green Alchemist, and he says hi, and he's setting up a music studio in his new place, and in about a month, he's going to send us some new music.
All right.
Okay, Green Alchemist, we're on the road here, and you know what's going down about what we've told you called the Reformation Act.
It is coming now, Commander.
And like in California and like in your town, Vancouver, legalize it, Yaman.
He sends his love to you both.
Ditto. We love you more, Commander.
Love you more.
All right. Are you ready, Commander?
Yes. Earl is on line D1. He's been...
Okay, you're back, Earl. Well, then you better get on now. B1.
Tara, Rama, Beth.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Hi,
yeah.
Earl.
Hi, Earl.
I was on my Linux operating system, and I was on Skype for an hour listening to Barack Obama's speech.
Oh, very good.
That was amazing. Wasn't that a wonderment? Wow. We sure needed
yes. I have two things to say. One, that CBC in Canada is going to run a documentary about the financial situation and about what could happen. It's going to be on tomorrow night, I think, either tomorrow or Friday.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Earl.
Yes?
I know you have two things to say, but I have a question for you.
I wasn't driving with the phone. No, just kidding. Okay, go ahead, Beth.
We've already had full disclosure on that. That's a closed subject now. Okay, my question is, not to change the subject, haha, have you found it in the Canadian news about all the arrests that were up in Canada?
I didn't hear anything about that, but didn't surprise me.
Right. Well, I'm going to keep looking.
Not from the Canadian side. They're pretty close.
And my number two thing was, over the weekend, I heard sounds in the sky that probably could have been fireworks, but I didn't see fireworks. But I heard, like, whooshing sounds in the sky. Mm. And what got me thinking was, maybe it's the dark trying to do something.
Could be they do want to play with their last fear called, which is a fake alien invasion. And understand they do have silent craft, yet it's like the story in The Lord of the Rings. It may look fair, but it feels foul.
Mm-hmm.
And you gotta feel it with your heart and the love coming out of those craft. Otherwise it's, you know, turn around and walk the other way.
Because, like, I asked my parents in the morning, did you guys hear anything last night? They're like, no. And it was long enough to wake up anyone in the house.
I don't know what to say.
What was that?
He was saying he asked his parents and they didn't hear any whooshing sounds or funny sounds from the sky.
Oh. Well, when the student is ready, then the experience arrives, you know?
Yeah. They might have to watch you get it, then they'll get it.
Yeah, there's layers of things that are coming off quite quickly, though.
If they were born before the bomb, it just has to do with that generation.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
In general, that's true. Born before the bomb.
That's 1945 of what I speak of. It's got to do with the change in the timelines when they detonated Fat Man and Little Boy. It was time for Ashtar and Sananda to show up.
Yeah. And they did. And they gave more strict parameters, you might say, over the years.
That's right.
Yet it was going to be necessary for someone like Barack Obama to give a speech like he just gave today.
And that's why I asked her last
to
night.
To come to this place where people can really get back to, let's just get practical here and read.
No dates, no nukes, no flukes.
Let's do these things that we know work.
Yes.
Together. And building the new technology that we're going to have now.
This is bringing in, as he is saying, entrepreneurs from the private sector. This brings directly in people like Peter Joseph, Jacques Fresco of the Phoenix.
Hi, I'm Colleen Dinnerty from the Free Speech Media Network. Hope you're enjoying our music channels. Who's your comments on our wall? Thanks, and stay tuned.
Sorry about that. That was because I had the free speech page open that I'm about to play Superpower and.
All right, let's go do this now.
Yeah.
How somebody will be okay with this? Is 2 hours over there at Radioville. Are we okay? Go ahead.
We're okay, my friend. We're okay.
Okay.
All right.
Hang on, I gotta reload.
Oh, Rama.
Well, we're moving a bit. Slow.
A little wonky, I would say.
Yeah.
I'm feeling it.
I noticed that this is a Sony. This little, tiny little microphone is a Sony.
Oh.
That's what we know about it so far. It's very tiny.
I'm just waiting for the page to open up here.
20 years old.
It's 20 years old? Does
oh
that mean it's
God.
Out of print? I mean, it's not findable anymore. You don't know? Well, look. Linda just told me that this little Sony microphone is 20 years old, everybody.
Linda, you better be sure that they hand that over to you before they leave. I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying it sounds so good. I might tell you to take it with you.
Well, we'll find it.
Just
we'll
joking,
find
Linda.
It. Wow.
It's taking this a little bit to open up here. Hang on.
Why did I go? Do you know what that is about?
It's just because, you know, things are buffering and moving a bit.
Does that mean we're going to have trouble?
No. It just means it's going to take a moment in time, and we all got to be patient with how things open.
So what?
Happy energies, right? My whole
eye is buzzing. Oops. This is not...
You know, in a couple of hours, it's going to be the 9th of September.
Yeah, it is.
We're going to be in a 72-hour period. It's a lot of work.
That is absolutely right.
Okay, here we go. This is Superpower coming up.
I just started,
and it's going to go on.
Okay,
here we go.
Thank you.
We have a breaking news story to tell you about. Apparently, a plane has just crashed into the World Trade Center.
Hi, I'm Christy Johnson. 9/11 was the Pearl Harbor of my day. These events became a major turning point in my life. Like most Americans, I was stuck. How could a superpower be attacked like this with no resistance? The government told us we were being attacked because of our freedoms. Something just didn't seem right. There had to be more to it than this. So I decided to ask others what they thought.
My definition of superpower is a power that has no rivals, that can wield its influence at will, that can impose its own policy, its own hegemony at will, can go where it wants to go, and not worry about the consequences. We are that superpower.
The United States emerged from the cinders of World War II with its industrial base still intact and the only country with the atomic bomb. It was without question the most powerful nation on Earth. What was done with this unprecedented power, the effects it had on our republic and the rest of the world, is the story of superpower. President Truman said, "The only thing new in the world is the history you don't know." Well, I wanted to know more. Why are we the only remaining superpower? Did U.S. foreign policy and military actions factor into this attack on 9/11? Immediately after World War II, the United States began influencing and intervening in foreign governments to an extent and in a manner unparalleled in history. The National Security Act of 1947 fundamentally changed and reorganized the United States military establishments, created the National Security Council, and has since been used as the pretext for the extra-constitutional powers in the name of national security. Passed in a time of fear during the Cold War, the National Security Act also created the CIA as an intelligence gathering agency. But almost immediately, the CIA expanded into a clandestine operations agency.
The CIA's template for regime change was when Arbenz was overthrown in Guatemala in the early 50s.
The United Fruit Company was in danger of losing a substantial amount of its lands in Guatemala. This was an overthrow of a democratically elected government, and it was because of the economic interest involved, not because of democracy.
We leverage politics, the decisions, and the economies of many, many countries.
The flip side of that, the failures have far outweighed the successes. CIA overthrow of Mohammed Mossadegh in Iran in 1953, Operation Ajax, the infamous case where a freely elected, democratically elected government dared to nationalize the oil. What it really came down to was ideology and economic supremacy and imperialism and U.S. hegemony.
Interventions called for a buildup of U.S. political, economic, and military strength by seeking control over world resources and access to raw materials, markets, and labor power in third world countries. Interventions in foreign governments became common practice. Claimed to be for reasons of national security, these interventions were often solely for the benefit of U.S.-backed multinational corporations.
The U.S. supports democracy if and only if it accords with strategic and economic objectives.
So many Americans are not aware of, we have a very tawdry foreign policy history.
What we were doing was overthrowing a freely democratically elected government because they dared to go against our economic interests.
Eisenhower's 1961 farewell address warned us to safeguard our liberties.
In the councils of governments, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberty or democratic process.
Many people don't realize that the U.S. was involved in Vietnam prior to the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution.
In 1962, when John F. Kennedy launched the invasion of South Vietnam, an event which has disappeared from history, this was after 7 years of supporting a brutal, vicious dictatorship in South Vietnam. Kennedy was at a point of making a decision in 1961, Kennedy, McNamara, and others. And they essentially decided to basically invade. You know, the U.S. Air Force began bombing with South Vietnamese markings, so it wouldn't look like the U.S. Air Force, but everybody knew. Authorized napalm. Initiated programs of chemical warfare, crop destruction, destroying foliage, and also initiated programs of what anybody else did, we would call ethnic cleansing, driving ultimately millions of people out of the countryside to, again, what if anybody else did it, we would call concentration camps, or strategic hamlets, or into the urban slums and so on, just in order to undermine the basis for the indigenous resistance. Anybody else did this, we would call it aggression. It happened in the United States without a flicker.
Our policy of regime change has made other countries concerned about about the goals of United States policy.
But the U.S. government had been overthrowing governments all over the world for quite a few years, especially in Latin America.
A case that we do know very well about, which is Chile in the early 70s. And Salvador Allende, again, freely elected, democratic electeds. Chile had the region's strongest, oldest democracy going back to the 70s. Allende nationalizes the copper interests, and Americans respond with hostility, embargoes. On September 11th, as a matter of fact, 1973 is when...
Yes, Beth?
I just wanted to take a pause because there's some shocking news that I just saw posted. David Cameron, the Prime Minister of England, his father died of a stroke and heart complications today out of the blue.
Rama was outside the room, so would you repeat that one more time when you answer?
Yes.
Rama, I interrupted the recording because I was reviewing the news from today, and it looks like David Cameron, the Prime Minister of England's father, died today all of a sudden of a stroke and a heart attack.
Sounds like they used that funny kind of machine on him because maybe he was going to tell the truth about Dr. David Kelly.
Uh-huh.
And other whistleblowers like Dr. John Mack in England who were going to tell the truth about Galactic Brothers and Sisters and all the lies leading up to 9/11 and the fake war.
Oh, there was all kinds of international people that confirmed 9/11 too.
And Tony Blair is a hair's breadth from going to The Hague as a war criminal.
Yes.
Along with Charles Taylor sitting there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The Camerons had their newborn daughter from last week, and he never got to see his granddaughter before he passed.
Mm.
And he apparently was a stockbroker.
Oh.
That sounds fishy.
Yeah, that's very fishy. That's very fishy.
Thank you. I smell cat.
Yes, they were on vacation in the south of France, and he got rushed to the hospital, and now he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That happened today.
I will ask some questions. Here we go.
Thanks.
Allende was overthrown, actually killed. Here we have a democratic government being overthrown by a CIA coup.
I could see what we were espousing to do. And El Salvador, out other places in the region. And then I could see what was taking place because I was one of those making it take place. Here is the public political pronouncement. Here is what we do. And they don't reconcile. You can't line them up. It's, well, we say this, but we're doing this. We say we're bringing democracy, but what we're doing is we're enforcing the rule of the oligarchy, the six families of 11 families in El Salvador. And we're slaughtering peasants. And all the peasants want is treat us fairly. That's all we're asking for. Stop killing us. Stop raping us. Stop using us as cattle.
Such coups normally don't take place in Latin America except with the okay of Washington.
President Reagan, July 27, 1983.
Yes, we want to underscore once and for all that the United States, along with our friends, seriously opposes the use of force by one neighbor against another in Central America. The United States stands firmly on the side of peace.
Many Cubans were hired to extend the runway at the Granada Airport. U.S. troops invaded to stop this.
October 25th, 1983. The U.S. Rapid Deployment Forces hit Grenada. 5,000 Rangers and Marines. By violating all international norms and bringing upon itself the hatred and condemnation of the entire world, the United States demonstrated the level of its complete disregard for the rest of the world.
Nicaragua, Grenada, Panama, the invasion of Panama in violation of international law,
the basic lesson is that the U.S. government will not allow an alternative society or government to exist in Latin America. I'm sure the U.S. government has not relaxed its determination to overthrow Chavez in one way or another.
Looking back, people have often said, well, gee, why did you support this dictator? Why did you support that dictator? Well, because there were other interests that we thought were more important. In the 1980s, we were supporting Pol Pot, Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden. Just to take three, you expand that exponentially.
We like puppet government. What big country wouldn't like a bunch of little friends around the world that do whatever they tell them, right?
The United States has not been in a declared war since World War II. Although not classified as war, military conflicts are given euphemisms, such as military action, armed response peacekeeping, police action, authorized use of force, military assistance, and military advisors. Regardless of what name is used, the United States has actively been using its military might somewhere in the world for the past 63 years.
We have chosen areas to become involved in where you have internecine warfares going on for generations and generations, which are extremely difficult to deal with. You're not just going to go in and say, okay, fellas, let's change things overnight. We're going to make you, build you into a democracy like we have in America.
It is a sensitive issue. It goes back to this whole notion of, should your culture trump my culture?
The United States asserts its power and military presence through an immense network of foreign military bases.
The 737 number is the official number. These are real military bases. This is American imperialism. It's out of control. One of the things that I study the base structure report every time a new one comes out is to see what they've left out. They've left out the bases in Kosovo. There are no mention of any bases in Afghanistan, 14 permanent bases in Iraq, none of the Central Asian bases. Many of them are omitted because it's too embarrassing to the country to admit that they've allowed American infidels to come in and set up a military base.
The four big ones that we've constructed in Iraq have Pizza Huts and Burger Kings and big BXs and naval PXs. They're really quite the city, quite the American city, very much like the bases we built in Kosovo and Bosnia. These are major permanent installations.
We don't mention any of the bases of any, or many of the espionage and secret bases in the British Isles that are disguised as Royal Air Force bases. There are no Englishmen on these bases, but through administrative agreements we made back at the beginning of the Cold War with Britain, we decided to call them RIF, Tipperary Wells, or something like that. And it turns out that it's basically a National Security Agency base for listening into people's telephones. There's a lot of them of that sort. Some of them are truly embarrassing. The big naval base at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, where the British High Court has just after 40 years ruled that we and the British took every single inhabitant of Diego Garcia, rounded them up, and transported them to some islands nearby where they have lived in abject poverty and misery ever since. We simply rooted them out of their homes and took them away. This is the way the United States likes to do business, as a matter of armed force. This is our empire.
No foreign forces have set up bases on U.S. soil. This would be inconceivable to the American public. Yet U.S. troops are stationed around the globe, and with this often come problems for the local communities.
Rapes committed by American servicemen leading to court-martial. The rate has been running now since the Battle of Okinawa in 1945, well over 6 years, at 2 a month. It is about as bad public relations as you can conceivably imagine. We claim to have today 38, 39 big bases. Those are interesting numbers because at the height of the British Empire in 1898, they had about 37. The Romans had about 35 major bases. If you are a Dr. No, and you really want to rule the world, you need about 35 to 40 really big, unbelievably expensive military bases. It's a way of life. It's militarism.
Since President Eisenhower's farewell address, His warning concerning the dangers of the military-industrial complex have not been heeded, and the problem has grown worse. Today, the military-industrial complex has unequaled influence over our government and military.
What's hard to understand is the failure of the Congress, the failure to exercise it, the powers of oversight, to use the power of the purse. Dwight Eisenhower's 1961 farewell address, in which he invented the phrase military-industrial complex. That's, we in America actually have a long history of imperialism. What we don't have is a long history of imperialism backed by a huge military establishment. And that's what Eisenhower was talking about. It had grown out of control. If the price of liberty is eternal vigilance, we in America have not been particularly vigilant. It's now so deeply entrenched that there's a very good chance that we will not survive.
We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. We recognize the imperative need for this development. Yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. The prospect of domination of the nation's profits by federal employment, project allocation, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. We must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
I think it's one of the wisest warnings that died in the 20th century. I think that Eisenhower is judged wrong in this country. I think he was very wise president.
Over the years, the Pentagon has become more reliant on outsourcing military functions to private contractors. These contractors have secured very lucrative contracts that not only supply weapons for the military, but provide support services, run military bases, and provide mercenaries. This influence even extends to areas of policy and strategy. Currently, private security contractors are not held accountable in war zones.
We've allowed unauthorized power, unsupervised power, wealth now combined with military establishment. No military commander in the history of the United States has ever had to deal with the kind of large standing arms industry that we have brought into being since the end of World War II. It has the potential for immense grief for our society.
We're 5% of the world's population. We're close to a third of the world's economic power and more than half of the world's military power.
This idea of Eisenhower's military-industrial complex kind of making its own game plan. Well, guess what? I'm starting to see that with my eyes.
I think we should go back to the what was considered a failed policy in the 20s, which was to be isolationist. I call it restraint. We should go back to being restrained.
Armed security companies, private military contractors, comprise the second largest force in Iraq, far outnumbering all non-U.S. forces combined. There are as many as 100,000 civilian contractors and approximately 20,000 private security forces.
Then you have all these contractors, you know, favored bogeymen or real bogeymen are would be Halliburton, Bechtel, and the like. And then you have the military-industrial complex much warned about, and a lot of that's been privatized. So we've got private military, in effect.
There's enough private contractors in Iraq now that if you stopped all American official military activity, you still have plenty enough people to continue the war if the president truly wanted to do it. They're not counted, they're not reported, and there is, above all, no oversight of this extremely lucrative activity.
We spent $22 billion on Iraq reconstruction and relief funds. That's it. Out of that $22 billion, 63% at least went to U.S. multinational companies. And the rest of that was to Iraqi companies that then purchased things from U.S. companies. All that money left Iraq, $2.3 billion, went to one company, Bechtel. They like to make a point that they were hiring Iraqis for employment opportunities. Iraqis can rebuild their roads. They can rebuild their dams. Why do we need to hire U.S. companies to rebuild everything that Iraq built in the first place? They have engineers. They have the technical ability. And as far as supporting us, we destroy the country. When during the invasion, we eliminated key infrastructure to demoralize and destabilize the state. We really weren't reconstructing Iraq. We had these middlemen extracting at least 20% for profits, probably much, much more in the average case. Then you also have 20% of every contract for Iraqi reconstruction relief in Iraq goes towards security, which then you bring in the private security contractors.
I think the story of Halliburton, based purely on decisions of expansion and war imperialism, this is waking people up to the fact that there isn't us and them.
We pay these contractors a significant amount more than we pay soldiers.
Halliburton is a major beneficiary of the war in Iraq. And it's driven by what? Oil. Look at the contract. Look at the first agreement we reached with the Iraqi government was to assure us that we have access to oil. And then how can you justify that, that oil is not the driving force? And you look at Somalia, there is nothing. So we abandoned it.
I'm not sure if you've heard of the LOGCAP program. It's the Logistics Civilian Augmentation Program. This is the main program that employs contractors in Iraq. The government said, let's see if using contractors is more feasible and more cost-effective than having this huge logistical infrastructure. Who did they hire to do that report? Kellogg Brown and Root. Kellogg Brown and Root, of course, came back and said, it's very cost-effective to use contractors instead of having this huge logistical infrastructure. And you know what? KBR then got the contract later on, of course. The only other company that's ever had a LOGCAP contract is DynCorp. It's an amazing opportunity worth billions of dollars.
Kellogg Brown and Root is a subsidiary of the Halliburton Corporation, of which Dick Cheney used to be the chief executive officer. They charge us $100 a bag to do GI's laundry, and have also prohibited GIs from doing their own laundry. Many of them, which in Iraq, want to do it because Halliburton does a crappy job. Stuff comes back smelly and it's simply not clean.
Unfortunately, the people that see how the money was spent and the people that see how what the end results are don't really speak to each other. So there's never been a full audit all the way through. $3 trillion missing over how many years? Who knows? But I'm not surprised.
There is no oversight because these are now private activities of a proprietary firm. The Congress has no authority to demand the record books of these companies, even though all the money comes from taxpayers in contracts for these activities.
So they decided to hire a contractor to do the contract oversight. Lockheed Martin's in the lead right now to go ahead and get that mission of being the fox that guards the hen house. For me, it's completely absurd to have a contract to audit contracts within a contract program.
The defense corporations have made many billions of dollars from the war in Iraq, and that's always on the minds of congressmen who are given bribes by these corporations.
It's simply malpractice, crime, embezzlement, trust violation to have uniformed military officers and executives of the Lockheed Martin Company or the Boeing Aerospace Company stand up in Congress and tell them, we'll have for you in 15 years a national missile defense that can take out an incoming threatening missile. We know it is. They can't do that. They know they can't do that. We're sitting here in the 50th District of California for this interview. Our congressman is now spending 8.5 years in federal prison as the worst bribee in the history of the Congress was Randy Duke Cunningham. He went out of his way to find military contractors who would bribe him in order to get him to put secret earmarks. Earmarks mean the secret addition to appropriations. You know, he was on both the Appropriations Committee and the Intelligence Committee for things that the government didn't ask for, didn't want. It's almost impossible to follow them. He even had a little schedule of what it will cost you in the way of bribes for the amount of federal contract that you would get to build this useless project. People have got to learn what
racketeering has gone on.
The congressmen are complicit in it because they want the money spent for jobs and things of this sort. You have a very strong impression after a while that, of course, the national missile defense doesn't work. It's too many of the tests have been basically rigged. But that isn't the issue. They don't expect it to work. The important thing about it is that it's expensive.
Budget is power, both in the military and what a general or an admiral is able to cause Congress to fund whatever weapon system it is or shipbuilding and all that. You know, it's peculiar. You know, the admiral or general retires and the next thing we see, he's a VP for him.
But the practice is being scrutinized since former Air Force weapons buyer Darlene Jurian pleaded guilty to giving Boeing Company special treatment on a contract for 767 tankers at the same time she was negotiating with Boeing about a potential job.
It's more important to put the dollar in his pocket than what's good for the nation. Ultimately, that's real treason.
The only reason we had a massive military was to combat this, what we thought was a massive Soviet threat, which in fact wasn't. But, okay, so that's over with. So you would have seen, you would have expected to see huge reduction in Cold War weapon systems, but not a single old weapon system died. Okay, and I'm looking at it from my perspective. Guys in the Vietnam era saw the same thing for World War II weapons. No weapon systems ever shut off.
The United States has retained the character of an institutionalized war economy, directed by corporate executives in collusion with the military industry. Even in peacetime, the American military expenditure has remained large, fusing the lines between militarism and war profiteering in what has become a permanently subsidized industry, better known as war corporatism.
They have been forever inventing threats of attacks against us by people using ICBMs, satellites, presumably, based in outer space that can be used to attack the Earth. Full spectrum dominance, as the Air Force rather obscenely like to talk about what we're trying to exercise over the world. We see this disaster of our unilateral belligerent foreign policy of pushing up against the erstwhile superpower, the Soviet Union, now Russia, pushing up against it by expanding NATO bases up to its border, bringing former satellites into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and now the threat of putting national missile defense sites, rockets such as those at Fort Greely, or there's a few of them at Vandenberg Air Force Base here in California, putting them in Poland and Czechoslovakia, and claiming that they are a defense against a rogue state, Iran, which doesn't have missiles of this sort, and certainly does not have any form of nuclear weapon yet, and certainly not a nuclear weapon that's engineered down enough, small enough to be put on the top of an ICBM. The whole thing is crazy and should not be tolerated. We want to know, where are the members of Congress? Why is this stuff routinely approved every year without any intelligent debate? Do the people really think that they are more secure to have these missiles buried in Alaska that have never once worked properly? Sakharov, the Nobel Prize winner, explained to Russia back in the last days of the Soviet Union, there's no difficulty in defeating Ronald Reagan's Star War.
Clinton, frankly, was maybe not as bad as Bush, but he was bad. And Kosovo, that was an unnecessary manufacturing war in the Balkans. The Kosovo War did not have to happen. This was about justifying the necessity of NATO.
There
have been
multiple
protests
for U.S. bombing of Yugoslavia, but we also saw
in
front of the
prominent
building, they're burning American flags, police everywhere.
NATO is an anachronism. It's a Cold War organization. There's no reason for NATO anymore. And that war was all about giving NATO a reason to exist and to continue to exist. And in fact, it has not only continued to exist, it has expanded. And in fact, that war coincided with the expansion of NATO into Poland, the Czech Republic, and Bulgaria, as I recall, was the third at the time. And what expansion means, by the way, is before you can join NATO, you have to bring your military forces up to a minimum level of readiness which means, of course, you have to expand your military, you have to buy all sorts of new weaponry. And guess who they have to buy that weaponry from? Primarily the United States, also Great Britain, France to a lesser degree. It's part of this whole monstrosity, you know, is the military-industrial defense complex.
In December 2001, under Bush, the United States officially withdrew from the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty signed under Nixon, undermining the landmark agreement. This was the first time in the nuclear era that the U.S. renounced a major arms control accord. The United States has become the greatest manufacturer and distributor of weapons in the world. The drive to sell U.S. weapons is now led by the defense contractors themselves, which sets an extremely dangerous precedent. War corporatism is a self-perpetuating system. Should corporate America be setting U.S. defense policy?
We use our special forces in numerous countries around the world, allegedly for military training, but also as salesmen for our weapons. We're there to try and get some poor country to buy some airplanes they don't need.
U.S. foreign aid is principally military aid. We export weaponry, but we don't give it away, we sell it. It's a huge money maker, you know. My belief is the U.S. military is kept now at a small critical mass just sufficient to absorb weapon cycles. And look at the price of a weapon. My God. And it gets down this when I look at it. Who are our enemies? Who are our natural enemies? We have none. They don't exist.
We don't manufacture very much. It's a much important anymore, except for weapons and munitions, which we are easily the world's largest producer.
You think back in the 80s, the Iran-Iraq war, 8-9 years of that. We're actually supplying both sides because, as Kissinger famously said, you know, best outcome for this is if both sides lose.
We formed the two parties and allowed them to kill themselves. And then we come out smelling like hill rose. In Pakistan, we did it. The Afghanistan situation, we created the mess. We created the Taliban. The Iraqi-Iranian war, we funded Iraq against Iran. We even urged Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. We create this problem. You go to Namibia, go to Angola. We funded UNITA, an organization that fought the legitimate government because we perceive the legitimate government to be Marxist.
We're helping both sides. Certainly we have some knowledge of how our ally is using weapons that we might have given them.
AK-47, M-16s are everywhere. Africans don't produce those weapons. And yet they're killing themselves. So yes, CIA or KGB or any of these secret organizations have been known for funding and supporting both sides.
We reawakened the Civil War by the CIA supplying huge amounts of money to the northern warlords and saying, we're going to give you one thing to help you out, our Air Force.
I don't want our people in the middle of the Civil War.
The Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, etc., are creations of the U.S. Intelligence services and others, Western intelligence services. Remember, they were concocted to defeat the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. So, and the ISI actually is a creation of the CIA.
We also had long history of working with the Taliban because we wanted to build gas and petroleum pipelines across Afghanistan.
You want to judge U.S. foreign policy, look no further than Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden is a creation of the U.S. foreign policy, actively recruited by the CIA, brought into Afghanistan as part of the Arab faction of the Mujahideen.
We were starving the Muslim children through sanctions against Iraq. There were sanctions after the Gulf War. And we were the main proponents of the sanctions.
The fallout from U.S. foreign policy sanctions in the Middle East has caused collateral damage for civilians. We have heard that 500,000 children have died. Is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice. We think the price is worth it.
Like Madeleine Albright said, you know, it's 500,000 Iraqis. We think maybe over a period of 8 or 9 years, this is how many Iraqis have died as a result of sanctions. And what did Madeleine Albright, the great humanitarian, say? Yeah, I think that's just fine. Well, we don't care about the Iraqis. Never have. I doubt we ever will. We care about resources. We care about the geostrategic placement of our forces.
This is a war about resources, taking resources of the third world from all over the country, from all over the world.
Every war that exists is basically a war over resources.
It is inflicting primarily the most vulnerable people in Iraq. They're elderly people. They're sick people, people with chronic diseases like kidney failure, people who simply couldn't get the most basic of medicine, but then overwhelmingly, children under age 5. And they died by the tens and by the hundreds and by the thousands and by the hundreds of thousands. And they died gruesome and ghastly deaths.
Economic sanctions in general are more of an expression of policy ideas. They're not going to actually accomplish hardly anything.
And yet they allow the economic sanctions to continue for 15 years. As long as you kept economic sanctions on Iraq, Iraq would not be selling its oil. This meant that Saudi Arabia could almost double the amount of oil that the Saudis were able to sell.
Preventive strikes, which is what the U.S. action in Iraq was, is not legal or not considered ethical under things like the theories of the just war, because in order for a first attack to be considered ethical, there has to be clear evidence that the other side is mobilizing for an imminent strike.
People like to make a distinction between preventative and preemptive. Preemptive is you think they're going to strike, so you get them before they do that. Preventative is they're not planning to attack you, but you think that the war would be good in the long run because you prevent them from doing something that would harm your interest.
This is called a war of aggression, what we did in Iraq. That was totally preemptive. That was the ultimate crime found at Nuremberg in 1946.
Abe Shulsky, the former head of the OSC, building this fairy tale about Iraq to sell this war that they wanted, is also working Iran now in the Pentagon in the very same place.
Saddam Hussein's military was in shambles, and he certainly didn't have effective military. Their military leaders were so bad that they even made General Tommy Franks look good by comparison. And there were a few military leaders who were even more incompetent than General Franks.
The powers that be, so to speak, the president or whoever has decided that they want to go to war somewhere, they will tell you whatever they need to tell you to justify that, whether it be true or false. We saw that with the Niger, Iranian, even during Desert Storm, the war I was involved in, there was stories about babies and incubators being thrown out that turned out to be lies, tanks massing on the border with Saudi Arabia that weren't actually there, which was later proven by satellite photography.
How did the alleged weapons of mass destruction lead us into the Iraq War? Chief of Operations for the CIA Joint Task Force Iraq, Valerie Plain Wilson, had a mission of counter-proliferation to investigate whether Saddam Hussein actually had WMDs.
I knew what we had from months and months of working and trying to find this intelligence. And here was a highly respected Secretary of State, and he's talking about things that in my world I knew not to be entirely accurate. Well, I think it was for me the first time that I stepped back a little bit from the operational weeds and said, what is going on here? Because it was clear we were going to war, and I thought it was a very thin case. They were taking bits and pieces, cherry-picking intelligence to make their case for war.
Her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, was assigned to a CIA fact-finding mission to investigate if there was actually weapons-grade uranium coming from Niger. When he reported there was not, and publicly accused the president and others of lying to justify the invasion, Valerie, a 20-year CIA veteran, found her name leaked to the press with signs pointing to the vice president's office as the source.
The spin and the way that they create the narrative is masterful. It's lie after lie after lie, but the lies are not discredited until after the fact.
What I saw in the summer of 2002 in the fall, right up to the invasion, was to cherry pick intelligence, to take things that were not true, that were known not to be true, and to present them as if they were true in order to convince or to allow the president, the vice president, to convince the American people that this was a necessary war, which it wasn't. It was not.
There's no way that they're rational link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And that one was just clearly fabricated, but that's just that they spun that web of lies so well, and everybody now knows that it was all false premise. Now, I don't know that Saddam Hussein was directly or indirectly involved with 9/11. I do know that he was an international terrorist. His hands were all over terrorism. And for that reason, I believe we were justified in removing him.
Well, I think the links to Al-Qaeda was probably invented. The possibility of that was pretty remote. They were enemies. Saddam Hussein is a secular monster, and Al-Qaeda are Islamist monsters. Hate each other.
The Office of Special Plans, which existed from September 2002 to June 2003, was a Pentagon unit created by Paul Wolfowitz and headed by FAPE. Under U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, they were charged to supply senior Bush administration officials with raw intelligence pertaining to Iraq.
Our office and the Pentagon were not supposed to be political, even though we have political appointees in charge. Well, they were not incompetent in propaganda. They were quite incompetent when it came to strategy. What we were seeing throughout the summer, and then once the Office of Special Plans had been formed, were actual written documents, sets of talking points, that were very different from the intelligence that we had been seeing.
Cherry-picked intelligence to support the view that Saddam was developing weapons of mass destruction. They're all kind of forms of deceit, like picking the kind of evidence that will support something that you intend to do rather than believing.
Your lies have been lies within lies.
We knew years in advance that going into Iraq would exacerbate the problems in the wider Mideast.
In 1994, the Secretary of Defense under President George H.W. Bush was Dick Cheney. He gave an interview explaining why the U.S. should not invade Iraq.
Once you got to Iraq and took it over, and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? How many additional dead Americans is Saddam worth? And our judgment was not very many, and I think we got it right.
It's not a catastrophe. It is pure debacle. The war in Iraq. It was based on complete and utter lies. It was for venal reasons. This was to have been a war for gain, for a small handful of corporate entities.
We know that we should have dealt with it as a matter of criminal law. We never should have called it a war on terrorism. It should, in fact, have been an emergency. We shouldn't have dignified. We have lunatically overreacted.
In the Iraqian war, I think it is not the question of leading or misleading. I think it was one of the basic mistakes that the administration didn't understand, that it is not Saddam Hussein, it is whom they are fighting. They are invading with indifferent culture that will generate resistance.
There's a real irony that the U.S. comes out and says, oh, we support democracy in the Middle East, but the two democratic countries in the Middle East are Iran and Palestine. They have democratically elected governments, but because they elected somebody that the Bush administration doesn't like, then they don't get it.
After they failed to develop weapons of mass destruction, the party line shifted. The goal was really to bring democracy. What the press calls Bush's messianic mission to bring democracy to Iraq and the world and Mars and so on.
There are people in the administration. John J. Garner, he did an interview back in February 2004, Government Executive Magazine, and he said, look, we're planning on being in Iraq for 20 or 30 years.
I regret, however, that a sound post-interest strategy was not formulated, and I don't believe there was one.
We've gone after the wrong people, and when we did go after them, we really didn't have a program. We really didn't know what we wanted to accomplish.
Without the excuse of weapons of mass destruction, is there an underlying agenda for the invasion of Iraq?
I really don't think that we would have done what we had done in Iraq if the oil factor wasn't there.
This kind of discourse is a clearly imperializing discourse that justifies intervention in parts of the world where one would like to establish military bases, where one would like to have control over the oil.
That was the main rationale behind Operation Desert Shield. was to protect the oil interests of the region.
There were, in fact, major Texas-based oil companies that had broken the economic sanctions, but in a very, very lucrative fashion. Bay Oil had been paying money under the table to Saddam Hussein's government in order to get the most lucrative contracts so that their name would be boosted to the top to get contracts to buy Iraq's oil. And another company, Odin Oil, had actually offloaded enough oil to fill 7 tankers, and these were Jordanian ships that were smuggling the oil and then offloading it onto the Odin Oil tankers. This is all according to Senator Levin's committee.
People are now putting their money, their reserve on euro rather than the dollar. And that is the most dangerous thing.
If the Saudi Arabians tomorrow decided that they wanted to be paid for their oil in euros rather than dollars, the dollar would collapse. That's the only thing that holds it up today. The stock exchange would collapse. We would be well on our way toward bankruptcy.
Saddam Hussein, about a year and a half before the invasion, had switched from the dollar to the euro as the currency for oil transactions, and this is a real threat to the American system. And Iran has threatened to do the same thing. That's one reason the U.S. talks about invading Iran.
Asia holds about, I saw about 50% of foreign reserves. China and Japan are financing the U.S. economy for a good reason. They want the dollar to remain high, that they want the markets, so they're willing to lose money by buying treasury bonds instead of investing in euros.
The Japanese and the Chinese and all these countries calling their debts, it will mean that America will be a country that will be asking for foreign aid.
You could have a banking crisis on any day.
If the U.S. was to pull out right now, there's a great chance that there will be a proxy war within Iraq between Iran and Saudi Arabia, the Sunni and Shia regional powers, that could easily spill over into Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. Once you do that, it will be only a matter of time until they start attacking those petroleum production and distribution points as a strategic objective in their little fight amongst one another. Once that happens, 20 to 30% of the global petroleum output will be cut off. An economic, global depression will hit the entire world if we lose 30% of oil production, even for a week.
If you ask the Iraqis, and we've asked them through a number of polls, a variety of polls, when they ask the Iraqis what they want the Americans to do, the answer is to get out. That's what they want us to do. Whether it's quick or slow, they want us gone.
I think you get out of it. I think you leave. What if we leave? There will be a bloodbath between Sunni and Shia. There might be. Will it be any worse than what we're seeing now? We have to ask ourselves that question.
I'm here to rally people to be against the war, work against the war, and to help us in our struggle.
And the people of Iraq need to know that George Bush is not supported. They need to see us out on the streets protesting against us.
Muslims under the Ottoman Empire were a threat to Christian Europe through September 11, 1683. They were defeated on the 12th at the Battle of Vienna by Polish King Jan III Sobieski. September 11, 2001 is thought to be the rise of the new religious fundamentalist Muslim empire against the Christians, perceived as imposing their values through globalization.
Certainly there are people in the Middle East who think that what's going on in Iraq now is just the latest version of the Crusades from the 11th century, the first time the West tried to come in and take.
I think part of it is that whatever might push the most strong religious, theological reasons is the right thing to do.
Our intervention in Iraq has been disastrous. It has led to a confirmation that there's a battle between the East and the West. Our presence in Iraq has led people to believe that there's a battle of Christians versus Muslims, that the United States is out to impose their way of life in the Middle East.
When fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in the flag and carrying the cross.
We were there to protect the oil fields, Saudi Arabia, from Saddam. Al-Qaeda was upset with Christian soldiers being close to the holy sites. That was their number one motivation.
Osama bin Laden turned, I believe, against the United States. he was part of a faction within the Saudi government or among the Saudi royal family that lobbied for not allowing the U.S. troops into Saudi Arabia. These are, it's the Holy Land. We can't let non-believers into the Holy Land, was his rationale.
What we're supposed to believe in the United States is that the U.S. would have, as they call it, liberated Iraq, even if its main export was, say, pickles and asparagus, and the world's energy resources were in southern Africa.
If the United States is really interested in democracy, there are plenty of countries with which we closely cooperate that are clearly undemocratic, and yet we're not pushing for regime change there. The policy of regime change may be perceived worldwide as being selective.
What we've done there, what the West, but particularly what America has done there, is creating enmity of an unfathomable proportion.
The United States is the dominant power in not only military terms, but in economic and cultural terms. So our culture is changing many parts of the world.
It has nothing to do with our films or our books or our television or our clothing. It has nothing to do with sex or religion. It has to do with the U.S. government going around the Middle East and elsewhere and bombing people, overthrowing governments, supporting dictatorships, suppressing popular social movements, torturing people. All these terrible things we've been doing for decades and decades.
Abuses by the U.S. government have taken a page from history with the imprisonment of political prisoners, torture and abuse, much like what was seen at the Soviet Gulag.
No prisoners that I encountered, you tortured. Now we have a prison for political differences with the President of the United States, and there is an application of torture at the prison.
There are some things that I think are clearly off, off limits. They should be off limits for a democratic society. They don't include torture.
There's nothing in the Constitution that says he gets to commit felonies. And yet, immediately after 9/11, he was ordering the Central Intelligence Agency to engage in this odd euphemism that they use: extraordinary rendition. Extraordinary rendition means the kidnapping of people any place on earth, secretly flying them to countries like Syria or Egypt, where they certainly will be tortured. We've had numerous CIA officials, high-ranking officials in the Middle East, say, if you want a good interrogation, you might send them to Jordan. If you want them to just disappear, you send them to Egypt.
It happened to me, too, in the Soviet Union, in the area known as the Archipelago Gulag.
Of course, it is easy to interrogate people when you can torture them. We know this from the Stalin's time, from the Hitler's time. It depends how we will torture them. But from the other side, it's fully useless, because if you are interrogating them in this way, and they have this strong psychological and physical pressure, they will confess everything what you want them to say. We know in the Soviet Union, after Stalin time, after a week of the interrogation, they confess everything, that they were Japanese spies, they were British spies, they plotted against this. So if you use it as the tool to control the society, I wouldn't say it was effective, but it had logic. But if you really want to figure out something, to find truths, in the worst way to make this, and you compromising your own system.
Stalin's tactics are still used today. Amnesty International uses the term rendition to describe the CIA practice of covert imprisonment of persons of interest moved to third-party countries, such as Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, to prisons referred to as black sites, for detention and interrogation. This circumvents U.S. law and has brought allegations of torture. The case of Maher Arar is just one example.
Extraordinary rendition presents some critical problems. First, it violates international law prohibiting torture. The United Nations Convention Against Torture and the degrading treatment or punishment, a treaty ratified by our country in 1994, explicitly prohibits the transfer of persons to countries where there's a substantial likelihood that they will be tortured.
I was detained and interrogated by the United States government, transported to Syria against my will, tortured, and kept there for a year. I'm here today because I believe it is my moral duty as a human being to help prevent what happened to me from happening to others. I also hope to convey how fragile our human rights have become and how easily they can be taken from us by the same governments that have sworn to protect them.
What is the relationship between national security and the image of the nation abroad? For example, if our nation has suffered a loss of standing in the world, does that impact our national security?
What kind of lesson are we sending to third world countries if we as governments in the West, we don't abide by our own laws? And on, this, and on the other hand, we are asking them to become democratic. I think it damages the credibility of the United States.
The largest known CIA covert prison is in Afghanistan, codenamed the Salt Pit. Locations and names of other black sites facilities are classified. Abu Ghraib prison was known as a prison of torture under Saddam Hussein, but later came to world attention with abuse of prisoners by U.S. soldiers.
Then later, there was public knowledge of photos that came out of Abu Ghraib. Bahri has covered all of this up. As long as there was nothing that made it to the public, no visual evidence. If there's visual evidence, you know, find the lowest ranking man that you can, court-martial and say that you claim all this up.
There has been a great deal of controversy regarding prisoners' rights, legal counsel, and violations of civil rights under U.S. policy. Torture is also a violation of international law.
Torturing a prisoner is something entirely new to the United States, particularly to its military. Came out of Rumsfeld's office by the person of Lieutenant General William Jerry Boykin. And I've served with Boykin and known the man for almost 30 years. Boykin's position, and I think he's still there, is Deputy Undersecretary of Intelligence. From there, the legal cover for that came from the current Attorney General when he was White House counsel, which is, the Geneva Codes are quaint. They're obsolete. You know, we can do it. Basically, we're the most powerful. We can do as we please. The theory of a unitary executive branch, which essentially attempts to use the commander-in-chief clause of the Constitution to place the president beyond international law, beyond the Constitution, if he invokes what he's doing to say that he's doing it in a matter of national security. Thus, we have the scandals of torture at prisons in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. Nothing in the Constitution permits the president to commit felonies and impunity. Yet a few days after 9/11, he issued secret orders to the Central Intelligence Agency to abduct terrorist suspects anywhere on Earth.
Whatever policies we adopt in the war on terrorism, those policies should be consistent with international law. And the abduction of people, the extraordinary renditions without access to legal counsel, all of those kinds of things are very troubling from the standpoint of international as well as United States law.
Terrorism is defined as the use of terror to achieve political goals. Yes, United States could be one of the states that one could consider as terrorist states.
We've been running and still are to military base at Fort Benning, Georgia, a school to teach Latin American military officers state terrorism. We've been doing it for years. Any number of famous Latin American torturers of civilians are graduates of what was called the School of the Americas.
Take Central America. There's no question that we funded people in El Salvador and Nicaragua that I would say are indeed terrorists. Our record in some parts of the world does not bear very close scrutiny.
If you want to counter terror, build justice.
political flunkies and lackeys like Boykin hoping to get that next star and having personal agendas there, execute those ideas. They turn them into fact. And in this case, the grand apostle of this activity in the military was a man named Major General Jeffrey Miller. Miller's the one that implemented it in Guantanamo. They were so happy with what they were doing. It went to Afghanistan within weeks of his arrival and bringing that technique to Afghanistan. We're seeing deaths during interrogation and tortured to death, smothered to death, waterboarding, some of the other stuff, dying stuff, face to first down into sleeping bags with somebody sitting on their chest. And then it went to Iraq.
It was a mistake in this long chain of mistakes, because it is one attempt to use non-democratic behavior in the democratic world.
Our actions really do make a difference. And for many peoples throughout the world, our actions in Iraq, the prisoner scandal in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and so on, have really hurt. For many people, what they view Iraq as is one that we have betrayed some of our own principles.
I went to Guantanamo, toured the place, spent the day there, and I am convinced that the people at Guantanamo are there for a good reason. Now, admittedly, I saw what they wanted me to see.
To talk about the Guantanamo Bay, the outside world did not look in the United States at the society that protected human rights. They say, no, you are violating human rights. And how can say that we are violating because you're doing the same?
Guantanamo does violate the Geneva Conventions. It's violating those which require certain treatment, not just of prisoners of war, but of civilians and people out of combat. So those people in Guantanamo are people out of combat. And we call them unlawful combatants in order to bypass this prisoner of war issue. And then we have the leaked memo saying we don't have to abide by the Geneva Conventions in this case.
They're not American citizens. They're keeping them not on the American territory just to keep them outside the American jurisdiction.
We've got to do a lot better job of identifying who people are at Guantanamo, their relationship to the war on terror, and providing them with the legal framework that allows them due process. It all has to be done within a legal framework that reflects both international and American law.
But the Geneva Conference control the features of it.
The United States offered high bounties for the capture of suspected enemies. Most people detained or sent to Guantanamo Bay detention camp were not captured on any battlefield, but instead were turned over to U.S. custody for the bounty after being taken from their homes or their streets with no proof of any hostile acts.
I guarantee you, it's a high crime and misdemeanor to order a felon to go out and start kidnapping people around the world. We see the scandals of Guantanamo every day, in which 90% of the people there were not arrested by Americans. They were arrested by the North Alliance. Our in the Afghan Civil War that we reignited after 9/11, and that these people were being paid bounties by the Americans for every time they brought one in.
If the truth about renditions and prisoners is hidden from public scrutiny, are there other deceptions by government leaders?
It's very difficult not to be gullible, because we want to believe that our government is knowledgeable. We want to believe that our government is not going to lie to us.
Since the Korean conflict, the United States has become involved in large and small-scale wars, insurgency campaigns, election manipulation, regime changes, assassinations, and covert operations continually in all regions of the globe to the present day. Covert operations, even when successful, may result with a negative blowback against U.S. foreign policy. Secret operations might be necessary for security of a nation, but there is little public accountability or public oversight.
Any secret organization is corrupt. It won't necessarily start out that way, but it becomes corrupt.
because it can hide personal failings, it can hide wrongdoing, it can hide venality, greed, lust for power. And who the hell's riding herd over it? It's simply beyond oversight. No citizen can hope to do effective oversight on the Department of Defense or the 16 intelligence agencies, since so much of what they do is secret. 40% of the defense budget is black. That is, allegedly concerns highly classified projects. I say allegedly because we don't know, and usually they turn out to be boondoggles of the sort that sends congressmen to prison, usually for bribery or things of this sort. Secret military organizations, I feel, are a threat to our republic. Delta Forces and some others, they answer to no one. They don't answer to Congress.
Covert operations conducted by governments, corporations, or other organizations, which are designed to appear as if they're being carried out by other entities as pretext for war, are called false flags.
A false flag operation is pretty self-descriptive, but it means an attack that is under it's a form of deception. It's blamed on the Arab extremists, but somebody else actually committed the operation.
It has long been suspected that the Nazis started the Reichstag fire to justify Hitler's crackdown on civil liberties, a false flag. Some say 9/11 is the modern version to take away American civil liberties.
Among the many risks in terms of false flag events, they could stage an attack that they blame on the Iranians in the Gulf. It could be no attack at all. It could be like the Gulf of Tonkin, just a complete fiction. And then start a war with Iran, and or do a domestic event and blame the Iranians on that for that.
It was a total lie that U.S. ships had been attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin. And that was used by Johnson as a pretext to expand the war.
We hear what we're told by this administration, and what that is everything that will demonize the Iranians. Take little bits of truth and demonize your enemy, such that at the slightest provocation or at the slightest incident, we will be, as a country, Americans, will be able to say, yeah, that's fine.
When a superpower uses force to gain economic and political control of production and finance capital in less developed regions, it is termed imperialism.
Traditionally, imperialism is thought of in economic terms, and we continue to exercise a great deal of economic imperialism.
One has to recognize that it is the dominant group that sets the rules, and to the extent that the Bretton Woods Accord, the Bretton Woods system, was created when most of this country were not even countries, nation states. They were still colonies. And this dominant group, the United States, Britain, etc., sets the rules in terms of the International Monetary Fund or the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which we call World Bank. And those rules were set without consultation or without even caring what the colonies felt. With the emergence of the colonies into nation states in the 60s, it became difficult for International Monetary Fund to still use the rules that were applicable in the 40s to them.
The World Bank and the IMF were part of the Bretton Woods Agreement. You can say they're sister agencies to the United Nations.
The World Bank is an international organization, therefore not subject to any form of congressional
scrutiny. The United States is the major shareholder of the World Bank. And as a practice, the United States always appoints the president of the World Bank. The Europeans appoint the managing director of the IMF.
When they give a loan, it comes with the demand that the recipient government cut back very sharply on its social welfare programs, and all kinds of price supports and health and so on. And this causes, obviously, great hardship to the people of the recipient nation.
Powerful forces like the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank are main proponents of globalization policies. Critics point out that this formula of globalization is being enforced and propelled by transnational corporations, largely unaccountable for their actions, aided by these institutions and governments.
The third world country is heavily indebted. It owes money to its international creditors. It owes money to the World Bank, to the IMF, to what is called the Paris Club. And it can't pay off its debts.
The main clients of the IMF and World Bank are the multinational corporations. It's for their benefit that these things are done. These countries have to cut back sharply on their expenditures to be more appealing to foreign investment.
World Bank and IMF policies of conditionality really caused a lot of harm, and they demanded instant release of price controls.
They deregulated exchange rates, and then prices just went flying high, and then they said, oh no, we can't increase wages because that causes inflation. And in the meantime, people's earnings have collapsed by 90%.
Always one of those is raising interest rates, often ridiculously high levels, 28% and plus, which has the effect of stifling domestic investment, because who can borrow money to invest and create economic development at that rate within the country? Very few. While assuring a high return on foreign investment.
If Suharto in Indonesia, maybe the most corrupt dictator in the modern period, has the billions of dollars of debt. And you don't take the billions of dollars from him and his family, who robbed him. What you do is impose structural adjustment programs, conditionalities, on poor Indonesians, which destroy their lives so that the debts can be paid off to the rich investors.
The money that goes into the privatization fund actually is intended to pay back the people who are the creditors and who are very often involved in acquiring the assets which are being put on auction.
Clearly, those policies that require overnight privatization, for example, they create hardship in the countries where they are practiced. And it gives the impression of taking advantage of a desperate person.
These economic policies are repeated worldwide. Many immigrants to the U.S. are indeed desperate. Often they are seen as scapegoats for the effects of economic globalization on a faltering U.S. economy. They take jobs unfilled by Americans that would otherwise be outsourced. The real problem presented by illegal immigration is security, not a supposed threat to the economy.
The militarization of the border was initiated by Clinton in 1994, Operation Gatekeeper. Something else happened in 1994. NAFTA was implemented. And they could perceive that the effect of NAFTA is going to be to undermine Mexican agriculture, which cannot compete with highly subsidized U.S. agribusiness, undermine small Mexican businesses, which aren't going to be able to compete with U.S. corporations that get national treatment in Mexico. So sooner or later, there'll be a flood of people north who better militarize the border.
There's no doubt that security on the Mexican border is a joke.
The world is not really going to make the difference of anything. Even to save the country, even to stop our people, this is not the way to work. There are other ways to keep your country safe. And again, this to think that we are human, that we are people. Yes, and we have families, we have life, we have dreams. We just want to be and work together.
When you're talking about the United States' relationship with Mexico and Latin America and the Caribbean from a trade perspective, we're talking about two main pacts. We're talking about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and SAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which includes all of the countries that are involved in the Caribbean Basin Initiative and several other Central American governments.
NAFTA is not equal. Even if you are working in a good factory, then the payment is a little higher than the sum of the Mexicans, but it's not the real pay that we need. That's why we need to work more about that, to be more equal, to have the same opportunities there and here.
SAFTA is not so good because United States corporations and the United States commercialization will take advantage of low-wage workers in these areas.
the U.S. executive director of the IMF once described the IMF as the credit community's enforcer. Okay. Now, the IMF is, which is basically a branch of, close to a branch of the Treasury Department, is dedicated, like a good deal of policy, to undermine the threat of capitalism and democracy.
Used to be that countries were considered superpowers. Now, what we see is that it's corporations, transnational corporations.
If we look, who is behind, let's say, U.S. Public policy, it's Wall Street.
I have a clue. I always say there are no more super powerful supermarkets in the world. The one that controls the market controls.
Regime changes, transnational corporations, and 9/11, how are these connected?
The IMF and the World Bank started to perform a new role, which was that of exerting control over these highly indebted countries and essentially establishing an alternative parallel government to the national government of these countries.
Behind the ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people.
The problem is globalization has gone so fast that we lack the structures to provide adequate regulation around it.
The elite of the elite would be running the world. In effect, investment bankers are my invisible government. The real power is behind Trump. That combines those two things. You know, what makes the world go around? It ain't love. It's money and power.
When a government is dependent on bankers for money, they and not the leaders of the government control the situation. Money has no motherland. Financiers are without patriotism and without decency. Their sole object is gain.
I think the end is the execution of American financial power wherever it decides to take it and exercise that power in the world.
It is a big idea, a new world order, where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause.
When we are successful,
a new world order.
We have a real chance at this new world order.
We are on the verge of a global transformation. All we need is the right major crisis, and the nations will accept the new world order.
There was something called the Project for a New American Century that actually was a position paper by some neoconservatives in government outlining what they would like to see as kind of the future role of the United States, which was basically to dominate the rest of the world economically, militarily, culturally. But they needed to have some change take place before that was possible, and that change might only be possible if it were precipitated by some catastrophe such as Pearl Harbor. Considering these people were major players in government at the time, one can certainly see where 9/11 would work to their advantage. Are you happy with the official story about 9/11?
The vast majority of Americans, unfortunately, buy the mainstream media version, which always turns out later to have been a crock of lies, usually fed by government officials.
I'm standing outside D.H. Griffin Wrecking Company, based in Greensboro, North Carolina, which was chosen by the DDC as the consultant in charge of all demolition operations at the World Trade Center site following the 9/11 disaster. The company response team oversaw and approved all demolition activities associated with the cleanup project. Weeks Marine Incorporated, the Cranford, New Jersey corporation, was the firm responsible for offloading by barge from Manhattan more than 1.2 million tons of structural steel and other debris. No one from FEMA would talk with me, so I tried for over a year to interview David Griffin Jr. to find out if he could shed light on rumors of detonation caps being found in the debris, or if he knew why the steel was removed before a thorough forensic analysis took place. Mm. All attempts to schedule an interview were rejected with no explanation.
It's all fakery. The Arab hijackers didn't do all this. It was an inside job. It was our own elements of our own government.
The recent poll, about a third of the population believes that the Bush administration was responsible for 9/11. Either they directly arranged it or they made sure it would happen. But what's particularly striking is that, and tell me something about American democracy, is that this huge number of people thinks that the government is run by mass murderers who are purposely murdering Americans and doesn't think they can do anything about it.
that goes along with the PNAC, Project for New American Century, who would take some sort of major disaster to cause the fear among people, who would then in turn give the government liberties that they wouldn't otherwise give them, give up their own liberties that they wouldn't otherwise give up, and allow the government to take actions that they wouldn't otherwise agree with the government taking in order to put that plan in motion.
The 9/11 attack on U.S. soil created fear, frustration, resentment, and retaliatory strikes against Afghanistan, and with subsequent preemptive strikes against Iraq.
Osama bin Laden's been dead since 18th of December 2001. He was at the Battle of Tora Bora. There was an American team that made its way there. There were two Afghan militias holding the Arabs, the foreign fighters, in that big, long defensive position at Torgar Mountain. Took several days, realizing that bin Laden was there, and eventually got an airstrike in late in the afternoon when he would come out of his cave to communicate by radio to his fighters. And he was bombed. If he survived the initial one, he didn't survive the night. The pounding on that mountain sealed off the caves, and the survivors had gone back into a collapse. And he has never been credibly seen or heard from since. One of the members of the team who brought that about came to see me, and then he told me his story. And a book is coming up about that.
There is no doubt that we've gotten a military, industrial, university, congressional complex of interlocking interests that maybe it includes also the world of journalism, which is actually turned into the Ministry of Propaganda, who provides the rationale for how we are still an exceptional country.
The media is slower than Congress in finding its backbone. We may be in the age that the independent media has gone the way of the buffalo. If we do, it's a great danger to our republic.
There's a deeply ingrained imperial mentality, which almost has a compelling effect on accepting the nobility of the state, whoever it's doing. Actually, there's even a name for it. It's called American exceptionalism.
We're all brainwashed, psyoped into, we're so good. It's American exceptionalism is termed, right? We're the only nation that's great in world history. We can do no wrong. We're always the good guys. And our government is too. Isn't that, been called the Disneyfication of history.
One of the main obstacles to making an impression upon the American mind about U.S. foreign policy, the main obstacle from changing their views about U.S. foreign policy, is that they hold a very basic and deep-seated belief that no matter what the U.S. government does abroad, no matter how bad it may look, the government means well, that their intentions are honorable. They may lie on occasion, they may blunder, they may on occasion do more harm than good. But this basic belief teaches Americans that the intentions are noble. If you hold that basic belief, it's very difficult to accept the idea that the U.S. government in Iraq, for example, is doing something which they shouldn't do, because the intentions are good. If you accept the intentions, you attempt to support the policy. Even if the policy seems to be failing, the policy itself is not questioned. And it's very difficult to change people's minds about that. They have been raised to believe this, that starting certainly with the Second World War, which we call the Good War, since then, you know, all our interventions have been for good purposes. We have been fighting an evil called communism, and now an evil called terrorism. We have saved, we have overthrown dictatorships. This is all part of the mythology.
What my rule is if the corporate media and the government tell you something and it's controversial, the government and the corporate media are lying. It's Reynolds' rule. If it's controversial, the mainstream is wrong.
Before the invasion of Iraq, there was that big demonstration. There were 2 million demonstrators that when we went home to our televisions, it was like there were a few thousand people in the streets. No, there were not. But those 2 million demonstrators in D.C. were shown
in the Arab world. They were shown on Al Jazeera.
The dedication to ensure that there be no alternative voice is near fanaticism. The U.S. is dedicated to destroying Al Jazeera.
I always encourage my students to go on the internet, you know, go to the BBC, go to Arab news agencies, and see a different perspective, because more likely than not, the truth is somewhere in between.
The government, as much as it would like to, cannot control information. And the fact is, technologically, it cannot control information. China is a totalitarian state, regardless of what they might want to say. It's extremely hard to manage the internet, to manage information flow in that vast country, and they can't do it. So if China can't do it, you know our country can't do it.
The anti-war movement in the 60s was an object of attack, a target of attack, by the FBI and other intelligence agencies. Whenever there's a challenge to this government's policy, especially foreign policy, there will be an attack.
In the 60s, many people protested against U.S. foreign policy about Vietnam and burned draft cards or fled the country to avoid the draft. In June 1967, former world heavyweight champion Cassius Clay, also known as Muhammad Ali, was convicted of violating the Selective Service Act after refusing to take the oath of induction into the Army to fight the Vietnam War, claiming that he was an ordained black Muslim minister and should be exempt.
We don't want to institute a draft. And so it's a dilemma for the United States.
There will not be a draft in this country. The American people are too disengaged from empire. They don't want a draft. They don't want to pay attention. The government doesn't want the American people to pay attention, and the draft would create that.
Fascism is an authoritarian political ideology that considers individual and other societal interests subordinate to the needs of the state. Without safeguards or new powers given to the federal government, American civil liberties could vanish.
This is the nature of fascism. It's not one party, two party, or a vibrant political system. This is institution against anybody who challenges the institution, which could be you people, any filmmaker, any documentary, anybody.
The United States has promoted a system of dominance, a system of inequality, and a system of violence, because any time a country has stood up to the United States, they've risked their lives and the lives of their children and their future.
Amnesty International said that the Military Commissions Act contravenes human rights principles, and an editorial in the New York Times described the act as a tyrannical law that will be ranked with the low points in American democracy, our generation's version of the Alien and Sedition Acts. This is a dangerous bill.
The United States today finds itself in an extremely fragile, unstable configuration in which it must make some very difficult, very costly choices, or else it will, like the Roman Republic, we will lose our domestic democracy and become a military dictatorship.
A government that is voiced by the people has participation in contestation, where people get out in the streets and then they contest whatever they feel like they can contest because they have no fear of reprisals.
We could be recapitulating the history of the Roman Republic, that we will continue down this path, stagger down under the facade of constitutional government, until we are one huge military-industrial complex. And at that point, we'll simply turn it over to the Pentagon. General Tommy Franks, the commander in the assault on Baghdad, has already said in print that in case of another 9/11, he sees no choice but for us to take over.
Since 9/11, of course, we all have seen this restriction of civil liberties, the increase of the police state. Now, where this leads is hard to say.
There is nothing more unstable than a country that combines domestic democracy with a foreign empire. That it can be one or the other, an imperialist nation or a democratic nation. But if it tries to be both, it's going to lose its democracy. That the military ultimately will take over.
Ever since the attack on 9/11, we've been wrestling with the constitutional dilemmas of national security, presidential war powers, and the place of constitutional civil liberties. The way in which we discuss, define, and resolve these issues are the ways in which we express our disagreements or come to agreements are of great importance to people around the world, especially to those in aspiring democracies. What is the price of freedom, and are we giving away our rights without question?
9/11, the attack, unprovoked, unsolicited attack, by the way, upon us on 9/11 has changed the way we live in this country. The Patriot Act is an example of that. There has been much criticism and much favor attributed to the Patriot Act, and I am among the latter group. I favor the Patriot Act. I think the Patriot Act has served us well. Now, sometimes we may have to give up a liberty or two.
It reminds you again of Benjamin Franklin's favorite statement. He said, if you give up your civil liberties for greater security, you don't deserve either your liberty or your security.
I think that there are a lot of things that Americans are put there to live with for the sake of security, including inconveniences at airports and things like that. I think when you begin talking about tapping telephone calls, about getting bank records and things like that without some kind of court order, I think most Americans are very, very uncomfortable about that.
The Judiciary Committee issued subpoenas for documents related to President Bush's program involving eavesdropping without warrants after Bush claimed authority to order this in his role as commander-in-chief following the September 11th attack. The vice president's office refused to cooperate.
I've never known an administration so willing to operate outside the law, even to operate against the law, in violation of the law, as this administration. Certainly not since I've been old enough to vote. We had an administration so willing to ignore the law. Well, I want the American public to know exactly what they did.
The Patriot Act, the most abominable, unconstitutional, hateful from the point of freedom piece of legislation since the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1798.
Policies that have been implemented here in the United States in the name of anti-terrorism do have serious repercussions for civil liberties, and I am among those who are certainly concerned about restrictions on civil liberties, whether they come in the form of legislation like the Patriot Act or data mining and things of that nature.
We live in an America that spies on its citizens without warrants. We live in an America that can read our emails and check our bank accounts without a warrant. We live under a regime that took away our rights to habeas corpus and due process. And that's anybody that George Bush says is a terrorist, they can do this to. I'm just waiting for my turn.
Any form of control, anything that heightens governmental control of the population, to me, is potentially destructive. And something of that nature, ID, smart chip, I don't think the benefits are going to be worth the potential consequences.
Question is, have you been engaged in espionage?
My answer to that question, Senator, it is citation from the Fifth Amendment. No person shall be compelled to be a witness against himself.
The American nation cannot, must not, and will not permit the establishment of another communist government.
You have this craziness of each society. The Soviet Union, Stalin created the same hysteria, fighting against terrorism and the enemies of the people, the McCarthyism, trying to do the same. It's very similar now with this anti-terrorist hysteria.
And again, the fascinating thing about the Patriot Act is that how long it had been in the works. 9/11 had simply all of a sudden offered these rather unscrupulous people unbelievable opportunities. And they went back and simply hit the print button on their computer. It was there and ready to go.
They did take full advantage of it. The Patriot Act must have been written in advance because it was submitted to Congress only days after 9/11. There's no way such a large piece of legislation could be prepared in that amount of time.
John Ashcroft told the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee the Patriot Act was so important that they didn't have time to read the statute before they could vote on it.
Imagine that.
Two members of the Senate claim they read it, and one of them is now dead, Paul Wellstone. He voted against it. Russ Feingold says he read it. He voted against it. Ron Paul and his colleagues in the House were given 15 minutes on the House intranet, the internal internet for members of Congress and their staffs, to read the Patriot Act. It's 315 pages long, and it doesn't read like a novel. I have read it. I have read it twice. In order to read it, you have to have in front of you the entire United States Criminal Code, because most of the Patriot Act says, in 14 U.S.C. 1523, move the comma, change or to and, change 6 months to 8 months. It will take days to read this. Members of the House, without having had the opportunity to read it at all in any way, never mind meaningful in any way, nevertheless, with no debate on the floor, fearing what John Ashcroft told them, voted for the Patriot Act, and it passed, and the Senate voted for it, and with two dissents, it passed, and the President signed it.
We in the Judiciary Committee conducted, I believe, 11 or 12 public hearings. Our subcommittee, the Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, and Homeland Security, we were involved with 9 public hearings. And when some of the opponents of the Patriot Act contend that this was not thoroughly examined, that's hogwash. It was very thoroughly examined as a result of 11 hearings.
The Patriot Act was being debated openly and publicly until the anthrax sphere. And in the anthrax sphere, all bets were off. New provisions were added into what was the version of the Patriot Act that came out of the House Judiciary Committee. And it was so hastily put together and the vote so hastily scheduled that not enough copies had been printed by the White House printing office for every member of Congress to have received it.
Now you may say, well, what about the First Amendment? The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. But the Patriot Act says if you tell anyone, your spouse, your lawyer, your priest, your best friend, a judge in a federal courtroom, that's right, every challenge of the Patriot Act has been an anonymous challenge, because if you reveal to a judge in a courtroom that you received one of these self-written search warrants, you'll be arrested when you walk outside the courtroom. Congress just forgot about the First Amendment.
Then all of these various delicts have been compounded by the Patriot Act that added new exemptions, new clauses, new gimmicks that simply make our police and intelligence services less accountable.
What about the Fourth Amendment? What about the requirement of a judge before the government can get information from a financial institution? Congress said, forget about it. The times are too tough. It's too difficult. We don't want another 9/11.
The President chose to do secretively, to order the National Security Agency to begin to carry out a massive collection of information against American citizens, clear violations of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA Act we're referring to, of 1978, which was also intended to get around Article 4 of the Constitution, illegal intrusions into our lives, and to at least provide some kind of court sanction.
Various forms of spying that the current administration has pretty much admitted to engaging in. And the way that they always admit it, you know, is quite interesting, too, is it's always for our safety.
Here's the bargain. Give me your freedom, and I'll keep you safe. It has never worked. It makes us less free and unsafe.
It's all based on fear. It's all based on fear. And post 9/11 is a prime example of that. The Patriot Act, and you create an atmosphere of fear, and then you undermine civil rights legislatively. And ultimately, the underpinnings of our democracy are threatened by that much more than they are by terrorists.
By fear mongering, it it helps them kind of consolidate power and let and encourage people to give up more liberty so that they can do what they want.
Today, the president tries to say, because of the commander-in-chief clause in the Constitution, if I said it's a matter of national security, anything I do is legal, and nobody can touch me. That's something new, and what we keep wondering, when will the Supreme Court wake up and begin to pay attention to what we in this country are about to lose? Our civil rights.
Congress has lost its backbone as a defender of the institution. The history of the 20th century expansion of presidential power is to get broader and broader and to begin to make more and more of these claims of inherent executive powers, to imagine emergencies even when they're not really emergencies, and to justify the exercise of power in that way.
There are dictators all over the world that the United States and Britain and any of the other Western countries haven't done anything to stop them for their genocide and for their, you know, actions in their own countries. But because Iraq has oil, I think that's the one thing that makes the biggest difference on why we're there now.
Why aren't we in Darfur? Joey Cheek is an Olympic gold medal winning speed skater. In 2006, he donated his winnings to the Right to Play organization, serving Darfuri refugees in Chad. What has the government done?
Darfur, for example. There we've been dragging our feet tremendously. This is something that people find rather difficult to understand, the Europeans especially, because we had always sought in a leadership position in helping people who were in dire straits.
I have today signed an executive order providing for the establishment of a peace corps.
The richest, most powerful nation on the planet has declared that a genocide has occurred. This is all in the wake of Rwanda. And to step back and watch it continue, what would you think of us?
Well, they'd be afraid. They might even be terrified. They might even regard us as the rogue superpower or as a nation that the planet simply can't tolerate to continue with those kinds of views.
Genocide is the deliberate and systematic destruction of a national, political, racial, ethnic, or cultural group. Modern democratic governments are not known to have committed domestic genocide. Documented cases of this are seen in countries whose governments are authoritarian, dictatorial, or totalitarian.
Since the end of the Cold War, we were going to have a new world order and intervene in different places to protect human rights. And that was all, came crashing down with the Rwanda genocide in 1994, when nobody stepped in as 800,000 people were killed in 100 days. And yet it seems to be playing out again in Darfur, since that crisis has now been going on for about as long as the war in Iraq. So, whatever we do now is going to be too little too late.
I think Darfur region is concerned that the United States just talks about genocide and wouldn't act.
We know when we do evil things. It was Ronald Reagan who invented the phrase for the Soviet Union, evil empire. But I also have no doubt that today we are the evil empire.
The price good men pay for indifference to public affairs is to be ruled by evil men.
The government's unconstrained. They can do what they think they can get away with, and they've gotten away with a tremendous amount so far. So we can only work to try and get the beast under control, bring this rogue superpower under control. Without another war,
there can be the potential for a rogue element if it's coupled with radical right-wing ideology, and it always is, it seems to be, because that's the sort of personality that gravitates to that world.
The war found that what we did was illegal, which is true. And as a result of that, in the minds of people, we look at the United States as a rogue country.
The president has engaged in activities that are clearly not authorized in the Constitution for him to do. That after all, he got a vote to invade Iraq by sending to the Congress a national intelligence estimate that he and the authors of the CIA all knew was dishonest when they sent it to him.
None of it had anything to do with weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, 9/11, or Iraqi democracy, or anything good for the Iraqi people.
Now, one of the big problems here would be that they could fast-forward this thing into a full-bore fascist police state as the worst outcome if they staged another 9/11, which I don't doubt they would do when they see the need.
The constitutional system. That's what's come apart. It's clearly a shambles. If today you believe the government in Washington bears some resemblance to that document written in Philadelphia in 1787, the burden of proof is on you.
Realize the Constitution is defunct, basically. That our country is behaving in the most radical of imperialistic ways in our name, creating enemies by the second, okay? Accumulating debt by the second that someone has to pay for.
The Bill of Rights is wonderful, but it's meaningless if the separation of powers breaks down. Checks and balances, that's what keeps us going. When you combine this with an almost out of control defense budget that is actually threatening bankruptcy in the country, the intrusions of the military industrial complex into the civilian economy to the point today that a great deal of what we're spending in this $1 trillion a year, it's $1,000 billion, more than any other defense budget on earth, than the rest of the world's combined defense budget. It's simply astronomical.
I believe in just the decency and the wisdom of the American people. They want to believe their leaders, but eventually you lie to them long enough and they realize the difference between what you say and what you're doing, and they start to turn. They always do. And they're doing that now.
I grew up in the shadow of the Mushroom Cloud, and since that time, Korea, Vietnam, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Panama, Grenada, the first Gulf War, Kosovo, Afghanistan, now this war in Iraq, and they talk to us about the great war on terror. The greatest terror that we face is the terror of what will happen if we continue to pour our wealth, our productivity, our resources into constant war. We're being driven and pulled in a very wrong-headed direction by some very reckless and dangerous people.
One of the paragraphs in my manifesto is this: it's the first duty of the strong to protect the weak. It's not the duty of the strong to prey on the weak.
It is not enough to be strong. We have to also have the moral authority to lead.
We have a way of dealing with unsatisfactory political leaders. It's called impeachment. I guarantee you, it's a high crime and misdemeanor to lie to the American Congress and people on going to war with a fake setup national intelligence estimate.
If a real prosecutor came in, which I would advocate, we have enough to arrest and no doubt indict by a grand jury a number of people I would arrest, from Bush Cheney on down.
I spent a number of my years as a college undergraduate, as an activist with SDS, Students for Democratic Society. I was chairman of the Columbia chapter of SDS, and I was the last national secretary of SDS. I was a founder of the Weather Underground, and I was 7.5 years as a fugitive. The problem with SDS in its latter incarnation, when I was a national leader, is that we moved towards violence. We had a theory of revolutionary guerrilla warfare, and we had a belief that this was a revolutionary time. Neither was true. It was not a revolutionary time. And even if it had been, revolutionary guerrilla warfare would not promote revolution in this country. So we were just outright wrong in our theory. In 1973, the United States CIA led a coup against a democratically elected government in Chile. The Weather Underground on the corporate headquarters of the ITT, the International Telephone and Telegraph Company, which had a number of investments in Chile and was purported to be cooperative with the coup. It's my belief that the property destruction plays into the government's hands. It allows the government to brand the movement as violent and terroristic.
In March 2007, ITT Corporation became the first major defense contractor to be convicted for criminal violation of the Arms Export Control Act.
I would take myself. You know, I haven't just been involved in the Senate. I've been involved in resistance. I was in and out of jail, facing a long jail sentence.
Many of us, I would like to say, were people who had already gone to prison. I've done 9 months for planting corn on a nuclear missile silo site. I've been arrested 61 times.
Think about what you're doing and make sure that, you know, you feel comfortable with your conscience.
I felt like I had been betrayed, not just personally from a 20-year career, but that, you know, that I should speak out while I still could.
My worldview changed in the military. The hardest thing for any man to lose is his illusions.
The Vietnam War was fought by the United States between 1965 and 1973. It was the longest war the country had experienced. It divided the nation and generated the largest and most successful anti-war movement in the United States history, often referred to as the War at Home, fought on the streets and campuses throughout the nation. Today we see protests about the war in Iraq with millions of Americans who have taken to the streets, who hold protests at college campuses, who discuss the moralities of the war, and who demand the United States to withdraw their troops.
The anti-war movement as a whole was successful. We helped end the war in Vietnam. We established the political context in this country under which there was no alternative but for the government to withdraw. Also, the anti-war movement was within the military. It got to the point where the military was so rebellious and mutinous that they couldn't be used. They had to be withdrawn.
Think about the great movements in American history. The civil rights movement that started in places like Greensboro, North Carolina. The Mutiny Times was a betrayer who walked into a luncheon counter and sat down and stood up for every single. We need that kind of strength and courage from you again. You can make such a difference.
Each individual has to figure out how they best can contribute either to research, education, or activism.
I began to speak out against what I saw to be misuse of information and power and intelligence to foment a war that had been long desired, apparently.
I had turned in my commanders for violating the Geneva Convention.
Don't get a government job. Try to keep your independence, and that's financial independence. It's intellectual independence, which comes through education, a willingness to accept that your government may lie to you, because historically our government has lied to us.
This is the Patriot Act. It's a huge mistake that it will take us a long time to fix.
It is the duty of the patriot to protect his country from its government.
We're all citizens here. If there's something that we don't like and we think is wrong, do something about it. Write a letter. Make a telephone call. Send an email. Ask the question. Write the president.
Encourage people to talk to their congresspeople. Encourage demonstrations. Encourage people to talk to the media.
Educate people in a way that Gandhi did. Confront them with the truth and ask them to act on that.
The greatest impact of the civil rights movement on me was the notion that what an individual does can make a difference.
I went out to a major intersection on the border of Saudi Arabia and Iraq. This was the day that Congress authorized the president to do desert schooling. I had to get arrested or do something because I didn't want to be part of the military in any capacity when the war broke out. These tanks and heavy-duty artillery trucks were headed to the front line. Decided I'd hold up my hand and stop the traffic going towards the front line, which I did, and took off my uniform as a sign of resignation.
The power that each of us has in our own lives to think, to act, to choose what we believe and what we don't believe, this power, every time it's exercised, it is a
hand grenade against the state.
Know about what the law is, gentlemen, who understand the Constitution and the rights that we have, and educated, intelligent, informed citizenry is the best bulwark against tyranny.
Only an alert and knowledgeable citizen can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
You and I don't think we're wasting our time trying to make a movie to try and mobilize inattentive citizens to the dangers we're in and to their delicts as citizens.
I would make people accept personal moral responsibility for their actions.
There are times in world history when it is far wiser to act than to hesitate. There is some risk involved in action. There always is. But there is far more risk in failure to act.
Never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. What will you do?
Okay, that the director is Barbara Ann Stiegmuller. That's pretty good, everyone. Associate producers David Chilton and Michael D'Orio. Very amazing. That was a completion, and I hear we have to go. And we're going to play a song, right? And Beth, are you there?
Yes, it was very good. Thank you.
Right. You sound like you're ready to beam up.
You're speaking to a hologram, Commander.
Then maybe we should play a song and say, "See you on the bridge."
Sounds good.
Come on.
Okay.
It only appears to me to be me sitting here speaking to you.
I see.
Mr. X.
Oh. I'm not sure about that. Okay, we'll try. Let's hurry up. Okay. We've got 9 minutes, I think. Is it 9 or 8?
Okay.
Countdown.
Okay, how about this one?
Let's see. That one was fine.
Okay. Here we go.
Sleep good, everybody.
Yes. Thank you.
Namaste, everybody. See you in your dreams in the dolphin land.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Namaste, everyone.